Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and start the meeting. It is December the 18th, 2021. I am your host, David Knight, with Project JFK Suicide Dallas Presents The Journey on Trail of the Truth and the JFK Assassination. And we were hoping to have Larry Schnapp here to give us an update on the records release. I'm hoping he will join us here momentarily. But in current events, what's going on right now, it looks like the U.S. releases 1,500 documents about the JFK assassination inquiry. Cables, memos, and other documents shed light on Lee Harvey Oswald's Soviet and Cuban embassy visits. I have not had time in the last 3 days to look on the website. I've just given over a few things. That's kind of why I was hoping Larry would be here with us. But it goes to show that, 58 years later, we're still not getting the release of the documents, and they look like they're going to delay until 2022 next year in December, from what I was being told by Larry Schnapp and his emails that he sent. And he just sent one the other day. Let me see.
Okay. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
Hey, pretty good, Larry. I don't have the other Larry Schnapp in the room at the moment. So, I tell you
what.
Are you ready to show that what we were just talking about on the phone, Larry?
Which one?
You actually go ahead and talk about both of them. That'd be fine. I'm going to let Larry kind of lead off this meeting this time. He's got, an update on, his blender program, and also, he has a story he wants to talk about that was, posted in the, New York Post, Larry?
Yeah, you have the link. I sent you the link.
Yeah, I've got the link. Do you want me to go ahead and screen share that?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, give me just a second. Well, that didn't work well, did it? Okay, let's try that again. Okay, go ahead, Larry.
All right. Thursday. Let me get back so I can see your... Yeah, this was published on December 15th. The other day, and it you can jump over that. That's a video. It's got nothing to do with it. But voila! All of a sudden, the New York Post has discovered documents that supposedly prove that Lee Oswald met with this Valery Kostikov, who was a KGB agent / assassin in the Soviet embassy in Mexico City here. And according to the New York Post, if you scroll down, you'll see where they actually post, they link to the, to that document. And it's a rehash. Actually, it's a rehash. And another thing that I want to mention, right there, stop right there, because this is the famous L. Thomas photograph of where he's in the background and Lyndon Johnson and Jesse Curry is standing next to him. And this is the one that always gets published, all right? But nobody ever published, and also in the Oliver Stone movie. Oliver Stone publishes, I mean, he goes over this, he shows this, and there's this photo. But what we all know is that milliseconds after or before, the famous wink was posted, was taken, that photograph was taken, and it shows Lyndon turning towards Al and Al winking in return, as you know, we all know, probably mission accomplished. We did it. We made it. Here we are. And that kind of thing. And the way I see it, if these Oliver Stone and others who are still working on this case, why do they have to keep ignoring the wink, the Al Thomas wink? And that's something that, yeah. Do you have a copy of that photo, Dave?
Yeah, actually, it's, let me...
It's got to be somewhere, I know. But yeah, but there, here, it's, at the bottom is that that amazing discovery that the New York Post is talking about. And it's, like I said, it's a rehash. But why now? And why the New York Post? You know, so just throwing that out as food for thought for my colleagues here who are attending today. And I have that. I mean, it's not, it's not one of the best. You know, I've seen better. All right. And that's, you know, obviously it's a tabloid, so you're going to see a lot of crazy stuff. But yeah, if you want to go ahead and show me the wink, you know.
Yeah, let me pull it up here real quick.
That would be nice. I mean, because what, I mean, what more proof do you need? You know. And in the meantime, I'll just go ahead and pop this.
There you go.
There you go. I mean, what's going on? You know? This is the one that never gets published. So, there you go. Oh, boy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Lyndon is, he's grinning. He's ear to ear. Right here. I mean, you can see it, you know? And look at poor Jackie here, who's still stunned, you know, by, and still blood covered, you know? And there it is. And I was struck by also how Oliver Stone sort of ignored that when he presented it in his movie, the non-wink, but he didn't even go towards the wink, so whatever. Now I'm just gonna give you guys an update real quick here. I'm sure you got a lot of people. I'll take the screen here real quick, all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Here you go. Okay, so last time we were looking at the Dealey Plaza here, and we only had half of the plaza built. And the composition, as we know, Dealey Plaza is almost the perfect mirror image. Okay, so when you look at it from above, you can see that the components should be mirrored from one side to the other, the north versus the south. And that's exactly what we see, thanks to the cover map, okay? Because the cover map, which is the reference image that we've been using to construct the Dealey Plaza in 3D, okay? And by following it, it just, like I mentioned before, a lot of these objects and models up here, since they're also down here, but in a mirror, the Blender has a function where you can mirror the object and then just transfer it over. And when we did that with the knoll and the hills and all the, components here, it's a perfect fit. Okay, so you have both sides here, and as we were doing before, looking at trajectories and positions, we've got this one very interesting. I was just showing one of our colleagues, Peter, what it looked like from there, and I'll just give you guys a little. And I'll just render it, not in complete, I'm going to dial this down to 10, like we did before, and show you guys what it looks like from that position. I've been up there, and that hill is steep, okay? That hill is very steep. You actually have to be careful, because you could just roll right down to the street if you're not careful. And the position there, which, you know, people, some colleagues and some researchers believe there is an image there of a gunman in the cancellare. In the cancellare, you can see James Tate down there under the viaduct, and he's just been hit. He's already been hit, you know, with shrapnel there in his cheek. And so the position there, unfortunately, does not provide the angle of reference for the frontal shot, the one that both David and I believe are more towards the overpass. David's theory above and mine below, but basically the same angle. And this is what we see from that position in the cancellare by projecting back towards that position and placing a camera there. So as we have been able to completely fill out the sidewalk, the curb, this manhole here, we've positioned all the trees exactly where they're supposed to be. And what's interesting here is that some of this foliage here also provides cover. So I'm not discounting this position at all, okay? I'm only providing it so that you can see that, for example, since this composition is frame 255, which equals Alchin 6, the JFK limo is further down, but in for the frontal shot, JFK limo is up here, where you see Johnson, LBJ's. So that angle there, there is a problem, you know, for a frontal shot. Okay, I'm not saying that other shots could have been fired from there, but basically that's what we have. And a lot of really nice, really nifty pictures coming out. You know, and as you can see, all the lampposts are in place. This many monuments here was copied over. All the trees with their little gardens, you know, right here have been installed. So a lot of good stuff, you know. And like I said before, if you follow the color map, you shouldn't have a problem with Blender, and just use reference images, you know, that that you can apply to the composition that you're working on. And that's it. Thank you.
Well, appreciate that, Larry. And you know, good job on getting some more stuff added into the diagram and the map. I mean, it's always going to be like the work in progress. But yeah, if anybody thinks that something else needs to, you know, be on there, you know, please, you know, let us know or let Larry know.
Well, I would love to get everybody in there, but like I said before, the more objects, the more models, the more textures, the more vertices, faces, you know, the slower the computer gets.
Right.
And that's why I have to sacrifice precision, you know, for sometimes omitting some stuff. So that's, unless I had a supercomputer, you know, that I can do that, you know, but that's not the case. So.
Okay. Well, yeah, definitely. Great job on that. And, you know, anybody that wants to see a certain angle from Larry's map, you know.
Yeah. I'll be happy to do a rendering and email out. You know, it's no problem, no big deal.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate the update, Larry, and I think we all do. Well, I still don't have Larry Snaps in the room, but I'm going to call on Brooks. Brooks, you available at the moment?
I'm back. I was monkeying around. Sorry.
Oh, gotcha. Give us your take. I know that you stay up on the current events and also with the stuff that's going on. What's your take so far on the document release that just happened 3 days ago?
Well, it's not my expertise, my area of study per se, and I leave it.
There are guys that
you could throw out one of any 200 acronyms, Larry being probably one of them, and they could just tell you right away who and what. But I found it interesting they trotted Gerald Posner out onto the – made some TV appearances basically to comment on the document release, as we would expect. But my take really, no matter what side of the media you're on, is that the whole topic, the subject of the JFK assassination, is pretty much verboten. You know, it's radioactive. You don't touch it. And so what I saw with Posner being trotted out, and I happened to catch it on an episode of Tucker Carlson. And so you would expect from perhaps a conservative site, whatever, that particularly since we live here in the era of conspiracy theories about everything, right? About the coronavirus, was it a bioweapon? I mean, it's really entertaining to be alive today because there's a lot of stuff out there. But I think Carlson's position, probably by way of Fox, is just that it's something we don't talk about. So he pretty much has always, from what I know, accepted the Warren Commission as the true version of events. And so across the whole spectrum of media, and, I did catch a wide swath of comments, commentary, things that were posted. I think everybody across the board basically is not going to touch it. And I think that's been alluded to here in the last couple of meetings. One thing that was interesting was a comment that Larry made a couple minutes ago about I lost my train of thought. The mainstream media. Well, yeah, I mean it's I mean, this comes up almost every session that we have, if it seems like anyway, and it's unfortunate that we just don't ever get any traction. So we just have to basically plot ahead and do what we do. But I can tell you one thing that's interesting. You go out there. In fact, I saw some little postings and whatnot about the release of these documents, and you go and read the blogs. And I can tell you the citizenry today, across the board, it seems like, mimics what the polls are. The polling today would probably say that 75% of Americans, particularly those of us of the older persuasion, not necessarily those of us who were alive, but those of us who are up there in years, 75% of us don't believe that it was a lone gunman, right? 75% of us still today, as we did decades ago, America believes it was a conspiracy. Yet in spite of that, the media won't touch it. So that's why we exist. That's why we have Project JFK and other entities that are continue to keep their nose to the wheel and keep forging ahead.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm going to go and do a quick screen share here. For those that would like to look at the documents that were just released at archives.gov, you can see there is you can actually just click on the all and see the entries that they've done. Like this is from the NAR release date of December 15, 2021. This will have your So have your document date, document type, file number. I'm sure that most people that have been on here and pulled documents, they are familiar with it. But for those that are not, if you will come over here and just click on the link, it will bring up the document, and then you're able to download, save, print, whatever you'd like to do. But they've done, I think it's 1,491 documents was what the,
see at the bottom, you have to email for the bulk download, and then they'll send you the link so you can download everything. I mean, it's ridiculous to have to download each one of them individually. That's, but see the fine print at the bottom?
Yeah.
You go there, and they'll send you right away another link, which is not posted there, mind you, where you can download the entire batch of documents.
Right.
Now, thing, obviously, they're not going to be searchable. You know, we're going to have to wait for Rex and Bill, you know, to take care of that over on Mary Farrell, but at least you'll be able to look at them.
Hey, yeah, I don't remember seeing the exact number that I was looking here on, this is just on the Guardian's website, but I don't remember reading exactly how many they withheld. I know obviously how many they released, but I don't remember seeing anywhere in the articles that I've been reading about how many they've kept, you know, under lock and key and still mm-hmm. classified. But, 1,500, you're 1,491. That's a great start, you know, but what the hell are they waiting for? You know, I mean, we should have them, a long time ago, but, I guess we get crumbs. So,
one comment. What Larry said before about some of the stuff being a rehash, that was one comment that Posner made. He basically cited one document and he said, all they did is unredact one sentence. He said, other than that, that document has been around and been out in the public domain for a long time.
So right.
At the end of the day, out of these 1,400 some odd documents, how much of that will be the case, we don't know until we go through them all, but there probably is a fair amount of that.
Well, Bentley put in the chat, thanks, Bentley, that by a CNN article, the release still leaves more than 10,000 documents, either partially redacted or withheld entirely, which won't be seen until December 2022 at the earliest, an order issued by President Joe Biden in October. So, Bart, you're with us, and I know you're a document guy, so why don't you, I want your weigh-in opinion on have you looked at any of the individual documents?
I only found two documents that were of interest to me, and they were Ruby related and JD Tippett. And one document was on TF Bali, and that was just like the other guys have said, like where they got rid of some of the redactions basically because that document was available before. And the other one, I can't really get to the name. I already posted through Malcolm, but there was additional paperwork, and that as well was like, mwah, you know, I'm not really doing a lot of serious investigating to figure this out in the sense that is it worth it, and it wasn't. And then the other thing was that the few hundred documents that I just glanced over, they are additional information or bits become available at a later date, again through the taking away the redactions compared to the ones that Malcolm published that I basically scanned in as such. I spend maybe, I don't know, 8 to 10 hours on the stuff, looking through it, and because I've scanned Malcolm's material in, I'm pretty familiar with what's that it all adds on to Malcolm's material. And so I emailed him the link, and I sent him the bulk download link as well. And, you know, the value of it, for me, very little. And from Malcolm, I'm going to maybe contact him in a week about this and what have you done so far and what have you found. I know that John Newman is pretty thick in it, going through all this stuff. It's a bit early to tell to make a good judgment call about all this stuff, but the fact that some redactions have been removed makes you wonder, like, well, why the hell wasn't it removed in 2018? I mean, what does 3 years difference make? Absolutely nothing. So it's more like a stalling exercise than I can come up with. There's still, as somebody said, there's about 10,000 documents left. I'm more concerned about the digitization of the documents in the 90s. This seems to be missed by almost everyone, because the material that was released, which I think was about 2 million pages back in the late 90s, 96, 97, and 98, haven't been digitized. So this is also why I have a lot of documentation in the collection that I created that is marked as not online, because they're all released in full, but of course you could only get them back then by visiting and requesting them from NARA. So I have the feeling, strong feeling, that the material from back then, which is really good stuff, especially for me, it's not been digitized at all. And I think it's completely overlooked. And it's never been, come up in someone's brain to say, you release all this stuff in 17 and 18, but where's the stuff from the 90s? And that's just not digitized. And I know that Biden has said that you need to digitize everything. And yeah, it's true. That's what Biden's totally right on, but he's not very specific because nobody mentions this, that the late 90s material is just not available in electronic form as such, you know, because it's never been reported by NARA or anyone else that where they say, like, oh, you know what, that's missing. Nobody did that. It's already been released 25 years ago. And that's a serious missing link. So, and other than that, I'm too happy with having finished scanning a month ago, and not intend to pick it up in the next few months because I enjoy the liberty, and I've been working on my own stuff in the meantime since probably early December, early this month. I've only started to work on things, and I found a really cool document about the searching of Oswald, and I put a little article together about that, which is on my site. In a nutshell, Paul Bentley says in an FBI interview, and I think in Feb, that he frisked Oswald, and there's good evidence for that, that they frisked Oswald right after the car left from the Texas Theater, because excuse me, I took a documentary from Stone, and I put it into After Effects, and I took from the most pivotal scenes for me, anything Oswald related, which wasn't that much actually in that documentary, but I've been told it. There's more in the 4-hour version, but I took screenshots of everything. It's great. You can basically point out to the sequence that you want to take screenshots of, so you can then get the high definition, get 30 JPEGs a second. So if you do if you do the whole film, you probably have, 50,000 images or something like that. It's just absolutely insane. So I really had to put the sequences in one by one and then just get the images. Now, the footage from the departure from the Texas School of Depository was probably one of the better copies that I've ever seen. So I thought, okay. So I found a picture, believe it or not, of Paul Bentley with a cigar sticking out of his mouth. Now, we know he was shot by Stuart Reed with the cigar in his mouth, practically posing when they had Oswald. Well, he sits in the back of the car as well, and they see this chump of a cigar sticking out. And the other thing was that the policeman with the white cap, Charles Truman Walker, and you can see him, he sits on the right. And they basically push Oswald down to certain, because you can't see Oswald's head, who sits in between those people. So I studied that, and spend some time on that, basically doing it as such. But the documentation, it also falls out of my remit. I mean, even Tipper falls out of my remit. And, you know, that was just what I'm looking for is in that batch. When the 90s material gets digitized, then I'll probably have a field day with some of the stuff that I haven't gotten hold of yet or be able to complete. There's one page from the LC Dorman HSVA interview, which is has disappeared. And he, not even Malcolm said as well, he says it wasn't part of the collection. And it looks to me that it's a really pivotal page, unless I'm proven otherwise. So, yeah, I sit on the fence on this whole batch thing that was released. But I had that also with the first batches that came out, 2017 and 2018. There was just information regarding who was an FBI snitch, things like that. And, you know, oh, Cabell was a CIA asset, and Bill Decker was an FBI snitch, and yeah, and so forth. So things like that, but nothing where I just went, whoa. I mean, one thing about the fingerprints I've been studying now is on three articles besides my papers are the bits on A, the fingerprints, B, the palm print, and C, the nitrate test. And it's going to be such big articles that I've decided not to put them in my papers because it just goes on. You know, in the end, the nitrate tests are absolutely useless because too many people have handled them. And then I found in my picture collection the, I always forget his name, the Black Star photographer, James Murray. James Murray did a lot of pictures of the one sergeant and two detectives who basically come out of room 317. And the first one shows the fingerprints, and then a few minutes later, somebody comes out with a palm print. It's a dog and pony show. It's just purely coming out there, holding it in front of the press, and get in the elevator and disappear. And the thing with the nitrate test is really funny because they are holding a pot of the wax in their hands, but that pot is empty because at some point there's a photograph. Of this stuff when what's his name comes out and with the hat on, and he basically has the pot, and there's one shot where he holds it, the pot, at an angle, and you can see there's absolutely nothing left in there. So that makes it even more intriguing. And I've got a ton of documentation that I have to put into sequence for the dates on all three subjects, so they'll come out some point next year. And with the so-called scourging of Oswald, so Bentley did, getting back to that, Bentley basically says in an FBI document that he searched him, which of course is true, but then Charles Fullman Walker, doing his HSCA, says is also that he searched him, but he searched him before he left the office of 317, just before Gus Rosen and Richard Stovall are going to interrogate him for about 10-15 minutes. And that doesn't make any sense in comparison with the actual frisking of Oswald just before the Markham lineup, because just before that he's frisked again, and this is when Richard Simms and Elmer Boyd find the bus ticket in his shirt, which apparently he had changed at Beckley, and five bullets. So you can't tell me that two people frisk Oswald and say in documentation that he had nothing on him besides his billfold. And then all of a sudden they discover five bullets and bus tickets. Now, if you follow that line, then that has, of course, massive implications in the sense that did Oswald have a gun and did Oswald go by bus? So when Rose is interviewed in 2008, I think, he says in an interview that Oswald had told him that the gun was thrown at him. And that's the same as what George Applin said in an interview with Bill Golds. And the bus ticket doesn't make much sense because, now they could have missed that because it was his chest pocket, but why would Oswald put that bus ticket in his pocket after he changed his shirt, apparently? And the consequences were, basically, did he go by bus, which I think that he didn't. And those five bullets, I think that's planted on him, just like the gun has been. So I thought that was quite interesting. And I wrote about that, so that's on my website. And yeah, we'll see what this coming year is going to bring as such regarding that. And the rest, I've got about another five or six articles in draft mode. So this next year, there's going to be a ton coming. And besides that, my papers, I've been working on the papers now for the last week or so. And I did get distracted by the paraffin test. And so back to the papers, and there's going to be about 900 pages. So you're gonna have a fun day or days going through that. All four papers are going to be released in one go. I hope in Feb March. So then hopefully done with all that. So and then I'm just going to basically concentrate on the articles, and from there on I'm going to start making little movies. And that will take me time as well because of the graphical matter, putting it all together as such. Then the only thing I've got now is all lined up, probably tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, is an article, or actually an existing page. It's on James Darnell. I found out a couple of bits. There's somebody who tried to fake Prayer Man, and I'm not going to name his name, but it was just totally fake because the head of Oswald was painted, plastered on the Darnell film, and the head's position and size are completely wrong, and also he picks the wrong arm to basically say where the ring and the bracelet are. So it's complete and utter fakery, and I told him I had to skip that film. But the good thing about it is that some of the screenshots I managed to get are basically getting bits that aren't very familiar for anyone who knows about the Darnell film. It's that Darnell was sitting in the middle, in the back of the car, and he had Kaus to his left, and he had, what's his name? Bob Jackson on the right. So what Darnell goes, it shows the sequence when he actually gets out the car. So when he goes out, it's Kaus's car, elbow. Kaus is filming down towards the grassy knoll where Wiedemann is standing filming, the Hesters and so forth. So you see the elbow with the camera, and then you see him move behind Kaus to get out the car. When he gets out the car, his camera is aimed at Houston, where the buses have stopped and are actually alongside the curb at that point. And there's people getting off the bus. So they know something's happening, and they get off the bus while the bus is static. And then you see the camera go back to roughly the bit where Tina Turner was standing, where she filmed. So all those people there, and the people that are going towards, like, you know, that shot where you see Piers Altman go into the to the grass and stuff. So you see all that be blurry, and then behind that, you see the police officer that stood there, just where the grass is starting, about 30 feet, if that, and he's on one knee and holds the gun up as such, and then he walks past him, the policeman, and then he films Ike Alton's standing completely stoically, like totally in shock, and he's just filming him while there's a car, almost like a Rambler. I don't know much about cars, but like a model type model, like a station wagon type thing, driving past him, so cuts into the frame, and then that's where it roughly stops. And so those little bits, and that as well, that particular sequence, I put through After Effects and got screen grabs basically of every frame that's part of that movie. And there's about three or four shots that I'm going to publish on the Darnell film. I'll probably do it tomorrow. So,
hey Bart, got a question about the timeline of what you were just talking about. How many minutes after the assassination? Like when he swung his camera towards Houston and caught the buses there. What time is that? Is that 12:32, 33?
No, less. It's about, to determine what the difference is between Wiedemann and Kaus and Darnell, mm-hmm, is roughly 10 to 15 seconds. First of all, there was only two cars behind, and he was in the second car behind. And on top of that, you can really do this well by basically timing Wiedemann's run and then filming the Hesters at that point, and you look at Couch, and Couch films Wiedemann filming the Hesters as such, and you combine that also with Baker's run. So it roughly happens about 10 to 15 seconds after. So I would say not more than 20 to 30. So that's it, basically. It follows up really quick. People give way too much time to the actual happening. Somebody posted something with a really difficult formula, and I was like, no, mate, it's right in front of you. You just look at when you start counting, actually, with when Wiedemann films the Hesters, and then you look in the distance of the Couch film to see him filming the Hesters, to see him filming Wiedemann filming the Hesters as such. And then you can basically count from Baker's, then you have Baker's run on top of that. So,
okay. The reason I asked the question is McWhorter's bus, his checkpoint was at St. Paul, and he checked in with a supervisor. There was always a supervisor there that held the buses, made sure they always left on time. It was kind of a mid-route checkpoint. So his time of departure from St. Paul was always 12:36, and he said the supervisor held them there, held them briefly, and then he waved them at 12:36, went down a couple blocks, got stalled in traffic. The police had basically shut off traffic at Market when you read his testimony, and they were asking traffic to go either left or right on Market, and they opened up a lane just for the buses to get through. That time of the day, the buses were running probably about every 20, 25 minutes. So the bus prior, this is something I'm looking at, the bus prior to McWhorter's would have left St. Paul, say, around 12:15, give or take. Could have been down there. I don't know if there's any relevance if that particular bus that you're talking about in the video might have been the Marcellus bus prior to the one that McWhorter's was driving. But he clearly, that's not his bus. So whatever buses are in that video, in that movie, are not, are the much earlier. And
no, I'm of the opinion that Oswald went in the car. He got picked up. That's what I'm on.
Well, I don't dispute that. I'm just saying in terms of what's relevant about buses, that's why I asked about the timeline, because those buses, neither one of them could be McWhorter's, because he's way back up on Elm at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's roughly what I'm working on right now. I'm actually trying to get this done as soon as possible, because it's been long enough, and I just want a proper break. I want to be able to say, yeah, I've done it for now, and until I go to the States when all this malarkey is over with the COVID, and find new material. For now, it's just I have a mountain of material. It's about a foot thick in paper that I need to go through and basically fill in the gaps, and especially the interrogation paper that I have, which was 340 and is now 380, and I want to throw 20 pages out, but I know that I've got to add on at least another 30 or 40 pages of material. So it's more to put the key bits to it, and I just found little bits that just fit in, slot in really well, and you know, get that done and get bits out that I think like they're not that important, and or just link to them as such. But yeah, I found a lot of good stuff in Malcolm's archive as such, which is also why I put my material on hold for 18 months by posting anything in that regarding those matters as such. So that's it.
Okay.
Hello, Larry.
Yeah, I posted the NARA bulk download link in the chat room there. So for anybody who wants to download, and you know, I already did it. Once you go there, you're going to see the zip file, download that, unpack it, and you have all the files there.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Larry.
Right.
I'm going to get to Bob Stolson real quick. He wants to share something, and then we're going to – we have Larry Snap in the room, so we're going to go after Larry here. And as soon as we get – I told Bob I'd let him to share something. Go ahead, Bob.
Dave, if you'd like to defer to Larry, please go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt, but I just had some things that I wanted to show. It would take about 3 minutes.
Go ahead, Bob.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Just a comment. Larry Rivera, great work. I fool with Blender, but my computing capability is not great enough to do all of the layers, and I see you smiling, so I know you know that problem. I had worked, again, I don't want to sound name droppy, but I'm one of the old timers. So I worked with Bob Cutler way back when he was providing maps to the Richard Sprague, who wrote the article in Computers and Automation. And I would just caution you, I looked through files over the last month and couldn't find any details, but there were some concerns about total accuracy of the maps, but I think they're good enough for all of what you're doing. You know, he worked with a lot of interesting material in order to create those architectural drawings. And we talked about it at one time, but I can't remember. This was in the mid-70s. So the second thing I wanted to just share with all of you briefly, and I'm sure some of you have already seen this, I'm just going to bring up my browser here. And what's intriguing about this, if you can see my Firefox browser, is that this is an editorial that appeared on the 20th. But what's interesting about the headline is it's associated with the Dallas Morning News. And I won't go any details here, but they this article was so important, it was actually reproduced as an editorial in my local paper as well.
Who wrote it? Bob, who's the author? Who's the reporter? Or the editor? Oh, this is from the editorial board. Okay.
So we'd have to research that, Larry, to find out who the actual author was. But I assume that it was approved by the editorial board of the the Dallas Morning News, and it appeared in my local paper called the Daily Gazette. So I thought that was of value. And then the third comment, I know there was conversation about JFK Revisited. I highly recommend that. Some of you have seen it. I thought your colleague David Bryan did an exemplary job. He was very self-conscious when he was talking about doing it, but I think that was just, you know, being in front of a camera and doing it. But the interviews were great. There were a lot of interesting comments in there. I thought there was an intriguing look at the mounting position of the strap at the butt of the Carcano. And that was intriguing. And then to Bart's comments about the position of the ring and in 133 A, B, and C and so forth. If any of you get Showtime, you can get it via your cable provider. However, I have a repository for JFK-related movies. So if any of you would like a download link to be able to view Revisited and some other movies, I'd be happy to provide it in the chat. Just put something in the chat. I'll send you my email address. And you can reach out to me directly, and I will send you the link to that. Dave,
yeah,
thanks for
the file, Bob, is about 3.2 gigabytes in size. I have it downloaded, but anybody who wants it, I can put it on CD and send it. But it's a large file. Unless you have a special download service, you know, or a repository where you can upload big files like that, it's got to go by snail mail.
No, I got it. I have a lot of video processing capability, Larry, so I have it compressed to much smaller than that.
Beautiful.
But the link that I can send would allow you to view it online. If you care to view it like on your television, yeah, you may need a copy, but I have a much smaller version. I'm not going to waste time looking for the size right now, but I will while Larry is speaking, and I'll send you the size. So I do have a smaller version, but it's still high-quality video.
Has anyone else seen the Josiah Thompson documentary that's on YouTube, freshly available? It's in high definition, and I got to say, it's I mean, I don't agree with everything he says, but I just thought it was a really interesting Thompson documentary. I forgot the reporter, but the whole thing is put together quite quickly, and the quality of the footage is very good. I mean, I was like in hog heaven with the quality of the footage that they used as such.
Think has probably the best 4x6 copies of the Zapruder film that are in existence.
Yeah, those come from work by, as I'm sure you know, by Robert Grodin. Is that, Bart, is that video that you're referring to, is that in any way associated with his book that came out a year ago?
Yeah.
Okay.
That and his first book. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I was unaware of that.
It is like a film, you know, if you were saying, like, if you would sell it in the old days, it would be like the DVD that is packaged with the book as such, as an accompanying piece. That's how I would look at it.
Yeah, I was unaware of it. Thank you for letting us know about that. I appreciate it.
I'll have a look in a minute, and I'll paste the link in the chat box. But I thought it was worth the time, and just because it was very slickly produced, sometimes even better than what the Stone thing does. It's just, I mean, its subject is, of course, just what Thompson worked on as such. But again, Bill Newman, he's got an interview with Bill Newman, the reporter does, and also Clint Hill has got an interview with him as well. So that's, there's more fresher material with interviews compared to the Stone thing.
There were three compelling pieces in that movie. One was his analysis of the two debris fields, which is a new, very interesting analysis, which helps explain why people that are experts in blood splatter get confused. Because if you follow, at the end of the movie, and so on, I don't want to spoil it. The other thing that was very compelling is the way he took that image of where Holland said he saw the reporter, the shooter, and then he goes exactly where Mary Mormon is, takes that picture, and where Holland is precisely where that image is in the Mary Mormon photo. And then he got Clint Hill to kind of slightly change his testimony.
Yeah.
He went from no to I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And the different sounds of the gun as well, you said that.
Yeah. And then the Stone movie, they did a great job on the chain of custody problems with CE-399. And I have two doctor friends who are avid or like staunch anti-conspiracy people. And after they saw the Stone movie, they went, They weren't quite over yet, but they said, oh, this is really interesting. And then, I was very happy that they gave Jim Gauschenauer the chance to, again, we did this at the Kappa, to have Jim talk about his conversation with Moore, and then have Dr. Miller talk about his conversation with Perry, and they both talk about how Moore pressured Perry to change his view. And so you have Dr. Perry saying, Moore pressured me, and then you have Jim Gauschenauer saying that Moore told him he regretted pressuring Perry. So that was, I was glad they put that in there.
The most important part was Bill Newman, because Newman says he gets shot in the temple, right? And this is somebody who gets interviewed an hour or less than 2 hours, gets interviewed and makes this on the WFAA clip. And he says that, and then you get Malcolm Kidoff doing the same thing. And the fact that when you look at the footage, which I think is from the Knicks film, how close Newman, I mean, the best eyeball witness in the world. I mean, what, how many meters? 5 meters, perhaps, or 15 feet? Is that like...
10 to 15 feet away.
Right,
yeah.
There you go, 10 to 15. Eyeball witness says exactly on, within an hour or two, says this, where the bullet hits the head for the headshot. And then I'm thinking, wow, from a timing perspective, that's absolutely amazing. It's like the freshest witness statement you can think of. And the guy gets completely ignored. And in the next film, you see how close, when the car or the limo passes by and you see that encircled. And I'm going, now that's criminal. But the thing is, a lot of people just dive into other directions, hit left, right, and center. But it's like, no. You've got the best eyeball witness. The guy actually could practically touch the limo. He's right on top of it, and he says, this is what's happening.
Okay,
and
but
to me, it's like, story over, done. Forget about it, what everybody else says. That's it.
Course,
Kittle confirms that. It's like, shut up.
But of course, in a courtroom, eyewitness testimony can be trumped by documentary or actual evidence. And so, and if you notice, when he was older, when they re-interviewed him, he wasn't quite as adamant about what he said at the very moment of the assassination. So I'm just saying that eyewitness testimony is unreliable to generally. And in a court, you want to have real evidence as opposed, you know, if you have eyewitness testimony, you rely on it, but any lawyer could have taken Newman's testimony and made him go from a certainty to, well, it's possible. It was like what they were, the doctors, right? So... like, for example, could he have told, is it possible what he saw was an explosion, not a, you know, as from the back? I mean, he would say, well, you know, I'm not a doctor, maybe, you know, and he was really quick, you know, so he was shocked by what he saw. I mean, there's always, but anyway, I'm not discounting what he said. I'm just saying that in a court of law, someone could have you know, made his testimony less compelling.
Sure. Fair enough, but at the same time, he doesn't even get heard by the Warren Commission.
Right, right. Well, that's another whole strike, right?
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, I'm thinking, hold on, that just points to deliberately leaving him out because from a distant point of view, he's the best witness you could actually have.
And the important story now almost is how the Warren Commission selectively used evidence to come up with their story and ignored, you know, evidence that would have exonerated Oswald or would have established a second shooter. So,
Larry, that's the whole story of the Warren Commission.
Right, right.
Over and over again.
Yeah, well, Larry, I tell you what, let's hear from you on the legal side and also about the document releases that have happened. Where do we go from, well, obviously we're in limbo, we're waiting, but what does that mean as far as what we just got 3 days ago to what's going to happen or not happen December of next year?
So we knew last week, so the week before this past week, from our sources at NARA that this was going to be a insignificant release. Basically, there are only 31 new documents released. There was about 40 documents previously identified as missing that the staff tried to reconstruct. And so when you go look at the NARA website, when you see the columns as with previously withheld, if it says redacted, that means it was previously released but in a redacted form. There's two other categories there. There's release, which is a new one, and then there's missing. So there were 40 documents that had been previously declared missing, and apparently there was water damage at an FBI location, and so the SNARA staff tried to reconstruct them, and it's basically a memo and some other information. So basically, you have 70 documents out of 1491 that were essentially new. Everything else that was issued was had been previously redacted. I haven't counted how many of them are released in full, as opposed to some, many of them still have redactions. So we were not surprised by this. And so Sunday night, I sent a mass. I have a list of about 50 reporters. And Bob, that's why I asked you about that news article that have covered or that they're reporters that have covered either 2017 postponements, 2018 postponements, or the Biden memo. So I sent them an email blast Sunday night alerting them that there's going to be a release on Wednesday. It's not going to be significant that we're filing a lawsuit. So we were able to get a lot of traction in terms of coverage, but it was a 24 news cycle. I mean, you can't do historical research in a 24-hour news cycle. I got on BBC World News Tonight. Jeff got on Dan Abrams' show. After I told Dan Abrams, producer, that I believe that Oswald wasn't the lone gunman, I was no longer an option for their show. And it's interesting because I learned a lot about how the news is generated. So you get a screening call from an assistant producer to see what you're going to say. Then if you pass the screen, then the producer comes on and they tell you what they're going to ask you. And if they don't like your answers, then you're disqualified. And alternatively, the BBC didn't tell me what they're going to ask me. They told me 15 seconds before I was going to get on. So when the music started, I had to dance. They got on two programs as well. And of course, everyone wanted to know, does this change the conclusions of the Warren Commission? Is there anything in there? And I said, look, you know, Harvey and Fitzgerald told their staff, don't put anything in writing. There's never going to be a smoking gun saying, here's how we're going to kill the president. And it's remarkable also how the media does not understand what the previous disclosures have revealed. They just don't, it's like it never happened. They just have not followed the story. Brooks, what does PNG mean? All right.
Larry, before you came
here, it's persona non grata.
Oh, okay, okay.
Hey, Larry, before you came on, we actually spotlighted an article that came out on the 15th the other day, I think Thursday, from your hometown newspaper, the Great Murdoch, New York Post, about Oswald and the KGB agent, Kostikov. And we're going, scratching our heads.
There's a backstory to that. I got a call from the National Enquirer. Now, remember last time I got a call from the National Enquirer, the reporter said, you know, when Biden issued the memo, the reporter said he's from the Enquirer, and I assumed it was the Philadelphia Enquirer and not the National Enquirer until he told me that he was, they only publish on Fridays. So I got a call from the National Enquirer that morning saying, my editor has asked me to write a story to play up the Russian angle that Russia killed the president, that conspired with Oswald. So what can you tell me about that? I can tell you that that didn't happen, that Oswald, even if he met with him, they were talking about visas. And do you realize that Khrushchev cried when he heard that Oswald, that Kennedy was killed? I know, but my editor wants me to write this story. So I said, he says, you know anyone who believes that? I said, the only person I know is Woolsey. So go contact him. Then he calls me the next day and says, well, we ran that story in the Globe, which now I understand the Midnight Globe is now lower than the, in terms of the pecking order, than the National Enquirer. So the story was even not good enough in the National Enquirer. So he put it in the Globe, all owned by the same company. Then he wanted to run with, these records show that the CIA, that the government was conspiring with the CIA and the Mafia to kill Castro. I said, yeah, that was news in 1975, but I've already written the article. Okay, well, here's some things you might want to enhance, that maybe that's why there are records, that there are tapes and papers from Kennedy's office that Bobby Kennedy had Mrs. Lincoln take that are still not released. And maybe that's why they're not released. No, I already wrote the article. So that was an interesting experience. Anyway, so where are we now? So we have this actually helped us with our lawsuit. We revised our complaint yesterday, and we're filing it either Monday or Tuesday in the Northern District Court of California against Biden for his failure to comply with the JFK Records Act. The complaint I filed against the National Archives seeking the underlying documentation that was leading to both the Trump and the Biden memos, they asked for an extension to answer my complaint till January. But we're going ahead. I'm going to send out another email blast when we're ready to file. And Bill Simpson will probably have a press conference on the courthouse steps after we file. Well, we're going to electronically file the complaint, but he'll go through the process of standing in front of the courthouse, and we're going to try to organize a press conference over that filing. But we're not taking this sitting down. This was disgraceful that was released. Of course, we didn't have any expectations because these are the records that the agencies had no objection to releasing. Now, it's going to take some time, and this, I don't do this work, but, you know, people like Rex and other people, it's going to be important to see from the newly released the records that were previously redacted, what information. It's very frustrating. I mean, they don't give you, like, red lines, and even Gerald Posner went on record as saying this is crazy. But Jeff Morley was trying to look at some of the less redacted records that were released this time and try to compare them by going to Mary Farrell and see what was actually, you know, what's the new information that was released. By the way, Jeff's going to be on C-SPAN Monday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time for 45 minutes.
Oh, cool.
I don't know which C-SPAN he's going to be on. I'm going to try to find out, and I'll send Dave a note so the rest of you can figure that out. I just don't know which, and he's going to be on, he was supposed to be on the Daily Meet the Press yesterday, but that got postponed because of the trial in Wisconsin. I'm not sure if any of you've seen yet that Todd is coming out with some sort of documentary. The guy that's going to be working on it is the one that is behind this TV show Billions, but they're going to be, it's going to be a psychological analysis of the presidents who were assassinated and their assassins. So that's another another documentary that's going to probably support the Warren Commission. And hopefully, we're hoping when Jeff does get on Meet the Press Daily that he'll be able to educate Chuck Todd. So bottom line is we're filing our lawsuit next week. I'll share the complaint with you guys when it's available. And, you know, you can always amend it. So we're just doing two complaints between two counts, failure. We're doing an Administrative Procedures Act complaint count and also a writ of mandamus, which is seeking a court order requiring the president to release the records. He's the one that has the ultimate decision. We were going to sue directly the FBI and the CIA. But they actually, while they can make objections, it's the president that makes the final decision. I know what the government's going to argue. I don't want to, you know, weigh you guys down with legal nuances, but basically there's some difference in language between Section 5 and Section 6 of the JFK Act. And the government's going to argue, based on the memo I saw when that supported Trump's first six-month extension, that they're going to argue that Section 5 expired on October 26, 2017, and that Section 6 now applies, and that has a lower threshold for a test for when the president can postpone records, and also that they believe that it allows him to do this vast group of postponements. So that's where they're going to go. I'm pretty much certain. You know, we're hoping that, you know, if we can prolong this litigation to the extent that maybe that will force them to, you know, release more records. And the idiocy of what they're hiding. There was one example. There was a report, some anonymous phone call to our CIA station in Canberra, Australia, that the Russians were behind the assassination. The reason that document had been withheld was because Australia did not want their people to know that they had a CIA station on their soil. That's why that record was withheld all this time. So that's some of the stupid shit that they're and that just shows you the problem with classification of records. So hopefully you guys will dig into the the 31 new documents. When you go down, again, you go down the list, but it says release, that's a new document. And then missing is, so if you maybe want to focus on those first and see if there's any, you know, I know there was a 73-page memo, I think it had been previously redacted, where it discusses how the CIA staff and stations did not believe Oswald was the lone assassin. There was also, in an unredacted form, we now know that when Johnny Roselli was under investigation by the House Select Assassinations Committee, the CIA asked William Morgan, who's an attorney, and it's admitted in this document now that he was a CIA cutout on occasion. They had him represent Johnny Roselli. So here's Johnny Roselli being under investigation by our government, and the CIA gives him a lawyer to defend himself.
True to form.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one thing? Here's the thing. I mentioned this just before you arrived. I've got a deep suspicion that the first release of the documents back in 96, you know, after the ARB and so forth, that first tranche of 2 million copies, has not been digitized at all. Is there any way you can find out whether that's the case or not? Because I can't find them with any of the releases. And yet within Malcolm's collection, I find a lot of documents that show up as not online.
So the one good thing that came out on Wednesday is the NARA did present their draft plan for digitizing the entire collection. Bill took a look at it. He's pleased with it. They're working, and they actually reached out to Rex Bradford so to figure out how to do this. But it looks like it's going to be a two-year process. At least that's what they're planning. They now have four archivists dedicated to this. So that's the one good thing. Are you friendly with Rex?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, so maybe you want to reach out to him to get more information. I'll try to find David. I think I downloaded that plan. Interesting. The first day that they the press release for the first day on the 15th had a link to the list of documents that they said were still withheld in full. The second day, the press release was edited, and that link was no longer there. Don't know why.
Nothing suspicious.
Right. But it's interesting that, you know, amongst the withheld in full are the interview transcripts of Jackie Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy with the that they gave to William Manchester. And I think that it's time for us to contact the Kennedy family, because they're withheld at the request of the donor, which is the Kennedy family.
It's at the library, isn't it?
It's at the archives.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's time for somebody, who maybe someone who has connections with the family, it's time to try to get those released, because they're the ones, they have the decision to, it's up to them to release it. The archives, it's an exception under the JFK Records Act. The donor is the one that has the only ability to release those documents. The last thing I want to mention is, except for the Kennedy materials, the rest are all IRS documents. And now that President Trump has been ordered to give his tax returns to Congress, I think that we could use that case. If we could get Congress to hold oversight hearings, Congress now, in theory, has the authority to require IRS to release all those tax returns. Because now the court has ruled that the Congress is entitled to review those in part of an investigative, you know, process. So that's something that if we can get an oversight hearing, that might be an avenue to get Oswald's tax returns at least.
But there's only one year missing. There's only one year missing.
Well, there
are. I spoke to Malcolm about this, and he said there's only one year missing, because I put a bunch of IRS tax returns in the archives of Malcolm online.
I don't know. So there are a ton. There's lots and there's pages of documents on the withheld in full that are IRS. I don't know if they're individual pages. You don't know whose documents they are, whose tax returns. But there's lots of tax returns that have been withheld. So I don't know how many of those are Oswald's. They may have been leaked to LaFontaine's. I don't know. Maybe he got them. Because LaFontaine supposedly got permission from Marina to release them, or at least they got possession of them. And I heard through the grapevine that both LaFontaine's are dead, and there's a daughter, and she is not receptive to sharing anything. So unless maybe if someone has connections with her or that family, maybe there's some thing there. They also released in full the first executive session of the House Select Assassinations Committee on December 9th of 1976. And I tell you, you can see why Sprague was fired. On that first day, he had already, the stuff that he had lined up already, he had interviews with nurses that were in Europe who were talking about that the bullet that was found was on Kennedy's gurney, and that the Warren Commission kind of just, you know, they basically changed the narrative so that it was found on Connolly's gurney. So he was really on top of things, and that was December 9th of 76. I mean, he already started an investigation. They hadn't even got the resolution was still in draft form, and they hadn't actually got their money yet. And he was already had a line of questions that he was going to pursue. The world would have been very different if he had stayed in charge.
Is that through do you have documentation to support that? Because I'd love to see this.
He said he spoke. Now, Sprague has donated his materials to the National Archives. So maybe it's in there. But this is a testimony of executive session. So he's telling the other representatives the result of his conversation with this. It was a nurse and a trainee. And apparently she said that when she was walking through that hallway, she saw the Kennedy gurney up against the wall, and there were bloody things on it, and the bullet was there. And she said when Conley's gurney came in, it was put up against the Kennedy. It wasn't up against the wall. And it was the one up against the wall that had the bullet. And at the Warren Commission said, no, no, it was the other gurney, not against when it was pushed up against the wall. That's when the bullet fell out. So, you know, I don't know who the woman is, and I don't know if he has this documented in his files. But I'll send you the, it's a pretty long document. It's just executive testimony, you know, but just amongst them talking.
Well, Larry, the thing with Sprague is that he set out to do what he said he was going to do. He was going to bring all the agencies and subpoena them and look for documents, and they didn't want that. You know, one of the first things he did was send Jonathan Blackmer and Kenneth Bruton to Mexico City to interview the Tarasovs regarding the supposed
right.
Russian tapes, you know?
And he talked about that then also. So this is December 9th.
Right. And the Tarasovs, plain and simple, said, you can't identify, there's no way you can identify that as Lee Oswald.
This was a murder case, and he was going to investigate it like you do any other murder case.
Right. So that's why they got rid of him.
Yeah.
Bob Saltzman, your question about who influenced Biden and Trump. Well, we know that the attorney that was recommending to Trump was an attorney at the NSC in the White House. And that person changed positions. In other words, there's a new person in that position when Biden took over power. But apparently it's the NSC that the lawyer, I don't know exactly what his title is, but that is the point person within the White House that advises the president on the Kennedy Act. So I don't know, as part of the NSC, I presume the CIA and the is talking to them. The FBI actually was worse than the CIA in terms of pushing back on documents. John Orr asked me this question, and since I got you guys on the Zoom, he wants to try to get the tapes from that interview. Was it with Giacconi or was it Trafficante in the 1980s when they were in jail? I think we have a transcript, but we don't have the actual tapes. And maybe I think those are subject to a court seal because it was part of an FBI investigation. And presumably, now that that case is long gone, there may be another avenue to get these released. These are all things that we're going to have to try to do through requests of NARA, and then maybe have to litigate them. But if anyone remembers that story where whoever it was either Trafficante or Giacconi said, we made a mistake. We should have gone after Bobby, not Johnny. But that was discounted as ramblings of a senile man. But John wants to hear the tape because, you know, as a lawyer, you kind of judge the inflections and your credibility of the person by the way he's talking. But I was just curious if anyone here remembered that story. But David, aside from that, that's where we are. We're going to be filing a lawsuit next week.
Okay, that sounds great. I think that's I think we're on the right track. I just wish that, you know, we would have gotten. Obviously, I wish we would have gotten the documents, but I kind of, you know, we had the feeling they were going to wait till next year anyway.
Right.
And
the worst thing, David, is that not only is it next year, but the order says, well, if you guys still want to postpone it, then you need to give us a date when you think it's going to be okay to release it. So, you know, I think, you know, that's why we need a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Because they're going to keep delaying it unless they're forced to release it.
Yeah, we've been able to force their hand. Otherwise, you know, we're going to keep dealing with this shit year after year after year. So, yeah, we've got to, you know, that's the nice part about the fact of what your team is doing, you know, with filing the lawsuits, you know, making them accountable for what they should have done, you know, decades ago. Not just years, but decades ago.
And the more important one, if NARA would, you know, if I can get NARA to release the underlying documentation, that'll be the memos from the NSC or the CIA to NARA saying, we don't want to release these records because. And then maybe memos going back and forth to the president saying, well, they recommend releasing these because. So those are the documents that right now are withheld. And under the Freedom of Information Act, there is an exception communications that go towards the deliberative process of government, but we're arguing that because these communications relate to assassination records, they are in essence assassination records, and assassination records are not subject to the restrictions of FOIA. So we're trying to, you know, navigate a path through the shoals to try to get these documents released, but maybe we will. So we're coming at them from two directions.
Okay, well that's a great plan, Larry. Bart, answer to your question, yes, I am going. I know you hear this shit from me all the time, but I got here's the thing. I come across something that I've had since I want to say it was either 99 or 2000. It was right about the time when Enemy Within came out, the Newcomb book. And I found the flash drive, that his son had, given to me with a lot of the work on there, before the book, or right around the time, what was worked on before the book came out. So I found that, I think it was Monday or Tuesday this week. I'm uploading that to Google Drive also, so I can send that to you as well. And then I'm hoping to get that out sometime between now and Monday. Things are kind of a little slowing down more for me at this moment, so I'm able to, you know, get back to task. And then also I want to let people know that if you do send an email, yes, I do see them. I don't always get a chance to answer them, and I apologize for that. Yes, I do want to continue receiving emails. I know, you know, there was an email that came up about a book. Had I read it, well, I really haven't had time to read hardly anything. Book-wise, I've been working on scanning and you know, kid shit. So, but anyway, yes, definitely, Bart. I'm hoping you'll get the link before Monday or by Monday sometime.
Cool.
And it's something that I know I shared it with Larry, or Larry Rivera, but I know that, you know, that was a couple years ago, and I'd forgotten where the hell I left that drive at. But I will get that to you, and I know there's some little tidbits you know, things in there that came directly from, you know, Newcomb Senior and then Newcomb's son. So
I've got a good tip for you. And I found out about 2 weeks ago, Jim Lovell's daughters have his materials, and the materials are kept in storage. And one is in Texas. One of them is in Texas, and I think she's the one to approach. I'll have to relook it up because I browse through the Dallas Facebook groups, and these girls came out of the woodwork when Lovell was discussed, because there was something, some post was made where Lovell was in a picture, so they were discussing him. And then they said, yeah, we've got all his work, all his papers as such in storage. And I'm thinking, they obviously don't know what to do with it, so they're just keeping it safe in storage, but that's something to chase about, because God knows what he actually took as a souvenir hunter, or what reports he's made that weren't submitted as such. You know, that's the type of thing that I'm very, very interested in, not just from a historic point of view, but just saying, thinking like, well, he must have had something in there that could be pivotal, vital information that could be, that's just sitting in a box in storage as such. So that was my tip. But I'd love to have a browse through that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, like we've talked about, there's so many different silos of information that, you know, we talk about the archives, you know, the National Archives, about documents that, you know, we haven't seen. If we were able to, and that's what, you know, we've been trying to do here at Project JFK, about gathering these individual archives and silos of information and get them digitized to get them out there. It's just like I knew that when we spoke about the, you know, the Newcomb, tapes and Newcomb files, I remember, of course, being kind of the keeper of the secrets running the Lancer conferences over the years that I did that. I noticed that, you know, everybody brought their flash drives to me, and some told me, you know, whatever's on there, just copy it, use it if you want to, if you don't, toss it. Well, I remember that there was something to do with Newcomb, and I showed it to to Casey a couple years ago, and I know I sent a copy to Larry a couple years ago, and I just couldn't figure out where the hell I put that drive at. Well, obviously, for the time that I had it, I had moved actually twice. That's what divorce will do to you. But anyhow, I did come across it the other day, and I'm like, okay, that would be perfect to send to you. So
I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But we've got to hunt this shit down before we all die. So that's the thing. That's the thing.
And that's the thing. Anybody that, you know, knows somebody that might have, you know, documents or collections, you know, if you have a way of contacting these people, you know, obviously point them to, you know, our website, point them to the YouTube channel. So they kind of, the thing is, you know, I know I've talked to a few people and they're like, well, I just really didn't know kind of what you guys were until we started watching the videos, or I started watching the videos of what you guys do. And, you know, there's a lot of paranoia, trust, you know, things of that nature. So, you know.
David, I got a question. Bill Simpich here.
Hey!
Hey, how you guys doing? Hey, what about Ted Gandolfo, guys? I've been looking for him. I was reading his stuff on the HSCA last night. It was very good. But he seems to have disappeared somewhere in New York City. I don't know if he's alive or dead.
He's long gone.
Your basement?
I'm gone. I think he was a cab driver or something like that, and he put together this this Jeff K. Journal, and he went into a lot of very sensitive areas. I think I have all of those. I think I have all the
video, Larry. He's had more video than anybody, from what I remember. He had his own TV show for several years in New York on mm-hmm. cable.
Mm-hmm.
I've been looking for Stan Clark's material. That's what Malcolm pushed me towards. He says if anyone knew people in Dallas, it was Stan Clark, and he was in regular contact because Stan Clark was in, Malcolm would be on this one of his visits and say, well, who do you want to meet? And he says, oh, such and such. And he just grabbed the phone and he'd ring and go, here, can we come by with the three of us? And it would like, yeah, all right, come around. And I think he did it also with Robert Gambling when he interviewed Robert Gambling. And
Mark Oakes is still alive. I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still alive. He communicated with me within the last year. And he took a lot of video. And
I
this
know.
Video is really important video. And, you know, he wanted a little money for it. But, you know, I think we could all pony up and just, you know, see if he'd let us share it among ourselves.
It's the same with, what's his name, the black guy who was declared totally nuts on Dealey Plaza UK, Michael...
Brownlow.
Yes. Well, he's done a bunch of interviews as well. I saw one DVD of it. And I don't agree with some of the stuff he does, but he gets to talk to some really important characters, and they speak freely in those videos. So it's not like he pushes his agenda on it; he lets them do the talking as such. But he's got I think he's got a five set DVD that he sells for $150. So might be an idea to get a copy of that, because you know, I saw that with one DVD, and that was quite good. And there was somebody from the TSPD in that one as well, so one of the women.
And the fair use doctrine applies on all this stuff. You don't have to use the whole video. Just take a snippet for like a minute. That's fair game. You can put that up and share it. We can't, you know, we want to respect people's work, but at the same time, when they've used the precious resource of an interview with somebody who, you know, they should be acknowledged, but at the same time, they shouldn't keep it to themselves.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, NBC keeps a pretty tight rein on there.
Yeah.
At some point, someone's going to have to challenge that. Because I know the
how do you do that?
File a lawsuit for declaratory relief. I've done it.
Yeah, they'll issue a cease and desist, and then you just, you know, tell them to go, you know, put it in the place no one sees.
Mm-hmm.
Where the moon don't shine.
Right. Yeah. That's what I meant. In articulate way of saying it.
I learned it from Dick Cavett. He told it to Norman Mailer.
Yeah, that would help me big time. To just get hold of the Donnell film, you know, and the Veepman film. They're both at NBC, so and they've been very, very unhelpful with everything. We emailed them 4 or 5 years ago, and they wouldn't give it to us.
The sixth floor is just as bad.
Yeah. Bill, didn't he cut a couple deals with NBC at some point? for some materials.
I think they did, but it was like on an item by item basis.
Yeah.
ARB also has a cook film.
Yeah, it's funny how the big corporados get to keep all their stuff and the small guys have to cough it up.
Yeah. I'd love to see
it. Look at the memos. I know there was an agreement. I think they entered into agreements with NBC. And by the way, the Clinton materials at the Clinton Library, there's about 100 boxes of ARB stuff. And I don't know if any of that material is not, you know, part of the National Archives. I would suspect, because that's considered government files, records, that there may be stuff there that's not at the National Archives. That's something worth looking at.
Wow, that's a thought. And you guys saw the post from the archives I was circulating about August 2023. They want to digitize everything at the archives.
Bart, we'd ask you about that, Bill. Why don't you, because I mentioned that you had seen that and you had some comments about that.
Yeah. No, they're going full throttle. I think they're trying to get it done literally during the Biden administration while there's still a friendly person in office. So I think they're going to, I mean, to me, if they're doing it in 20 months, they're going all out. I mean, that's a major effort.
Yeah.
That's a serious effort.
Where did we find that plan, Bill? I forgot. I know we saw the plan, the draft plan.
I sent it to you the other
day. Okay.
So, I can send it to you too, Bart. Anybody else who wants to
see it? Yeah, I'd love to see that. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's a big deal. It's like the best thing I think that's come out of this sorry Biden administration so far. They're just embarrassed because this is the bone they're throwing us.
Well, they actually, you know, when we contacted them before Biden issued his memo, that was the one thing that our source was telling us was they were really excited about that. They made it was like it's a typical bureaucrat. Like they weren't worried about the release of documents. They were really psyched about we're going to have this new feature that, you know, we're going to make all these things digitized. And that was so they were touting that like and ignoring everything else. It's crazy.
Well, you know, when you get right down to it, I think it's about 10 times more important because we haven't read this stuff. I mean, Bart and I are on the same page. You know, we just keep saying the same thing. We don't even know what we got.
And Bill, didn't you say that they reached out to Rex?
Yeah, I mean, for all we know, Rex may get to play a role in this digitization. It would be foolish of them to not work with him. He knows where everything is. He knows how to photograph it. He knows how to catalog it. He's one of the most brilliant people at, you know, creating the database there is, you know, that's quality work, you know. And so they'd be crazy not to work on some.
That's another reason we haven't, you know, I did the one lawsuit, you know, it was narrow, but it's really against the president in essence because it's their privilege. But we haven't gone after them because they have been cooperative and they're just custodians. You know, they really have no ability to make decisions about the records.
Well, they have the ability to do a much better index than they have. And I think, if you've been to the archives, you'll see why I agree with people like Andrew that the indexing there is shameful. I've been there like every year change, and you'd ask these people where stuff was, and they literally did not know sometimes where stuff was. It was awful. So if you weren't an experienced researcher, you have a lot of downtime.
That was the point that Stone made in that movie about that one person that passed away at a young age, right?
John Hunt?
Yeah.
Hunt was one of the best researchers we had, and I can only imagine how much time he had to spend in the archives to get what he got.
They gave him his own desk.
Where's his stuff?
It's with his family in New England, and his book is coming out imminently. The manuscript is done. It's quite good from what I've seen of it.
Cool.
Well, I tell you what, I want to do a quick, shout out. Basically, I always like to go for what I call obscure shit about the JFK assassination, and sometimes you just want that obscure shit just to take your mind off of how, you know, frustrated we get with, you know, documents, with, you know, not knowing what we would want to know, but we can't find it, or we don't get the answers we're looking for. And one thing I'm always like is the fact of, you know, just general people that may not have been in Dallas, Texas that day, but where they were at, what their story was when they heard about the president being killed. Well, one person that, you know, I don't personally know, I know I've went and seen him in concert, and they played for 3 hours, open and close the concert by themselves. It's one of the best damn concerts I've ever been to in my life was the Skinner Meatloaf. Now, I bring up his name, and I was talking to Casey about this, and also J. Gary Shaw and Brian Edwards. I've been following the story since mid-2000s when I first heard about it. And then just this year, back in September, he was on the Huckabee Show. And I don't usually watch the Huckabee Show, but I know that when I pulled it up, I just, you know, it pulled up in my feed somehow, and I said, okay, well, that's great. Let's, let's take a look and see what it says. But he was, Meatloaf was from, he was born and was down in from Dallas, Texas, in that area. You can see the video just by going on and just typing in, I'll do a quick share. I just typed in Meatloaf JFK story, and you can watch the YouTube video. It's about 16 minutes long. Meatloaf's crazy encounter after the JFK assassination. Now, what I bring this up for is because he finally went into more detail than what he had in the past. And I'll give you a quick backstory. He was 14 at the time. He, everybody was able to, get signed, excuses to get out of school if they wanted to go and see, President Kennedy while he was in town. So him and two of his buddies that were on the football team together, they went to Love Field. Well, one of his friends, his dad worked at Love Field. So he told them where his, where the motorcade would be coming out of, where JFK was at, and his friend went up and shook hands with JFK at the fence line. Meatloaf was a little more, shy about it and just kind of stood there and watched what took place. Well, then they leave and they go to a bowling alley. The name escapes me at the moment, but the bowling alley down there in Dallas, and they hear that, President Kennedy's been shot. So they go out and they start, talking about it, and people are like, you guys shouldn't be talking about that. It really had happened at that point, and they were on their way to, figure, well, if he got shot, they figured the closest hospital would have been taking the Parkland. So they're on Stemmons Freeway, and they get flagged over by Secret Service. Secret Service agent jumps in the car, Meatloaf's the one driving the vehicle, and takes them straight to Parkland Hospital. Well, when they get there, the Secret Service agent gets out and tells them, not to move. And they're basically right across from the limousine. They get out eventually, and they walk up and look at, the motorcade or at the limousine with the roses and the blood. And then they're actually, all three of them are standing there while they're being interviewed. I haven't really had the time to go back and look at my, footage, but I've got, hours upon hours of footage. And I know the scene they're talking about, it's one of his friends speaking to a senator or a congressman from, I believe it's Indiana or Illinois. I know it was one of the I states. And you can see Meatloaf standing there. Well, the other funny part about this is what I got a hold of Gary Shaw about was his dad was a Dallas Police Department officer. And we've been looking for, and I have a photograph of him, but trying to figure out, was he on the force in 1963? Meatloaf says his dad was friends with Jack Ruby. Well, hell, if he was Dallas Police, there's a lot of PD that was friends with Jack Ruby. But I'm not saying there's any alternative motive that, he was in on or anything, but I know that, Meatloaf came out and stated the fact that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald that killed the president, and he wasn't going to say any more on it because he'd been threatened, probably because of his, probably because of his dad. But, it's one of those obscure stories that, I'm going to write a little blog post up on it, but if anybody hasn't watched the video or heard the story about it, take the 15 minutes, take a quick break and watch it. It's interesting. It's one of those things where it may not be a repository of information of an archive, but it's somebody that, as a kid growing up in Dallas, what their viewpoint was. And there's a lot of people that have viewpoints as far as what where they were, what they were doing at the time of the assassination.
Hey, Mitch, can I ask you, have you or Gary Shaw or other people led any organized effort to identify the people in those photos in video in the immediate aftermath of the assassination? Because it's obvious some people have done that work, and I don't know who they are. I'd love to talk to them.
I don't know if Gary has. I'm sure he has. I mean, I've went in and kind of tried to pick out, okay, have I seen that person? What my biggest thing was have I seen that person that was, you know, at Parkland or right after while they were interviewing people, if they were people I could pick out, you know.
People like Seth Canner at Parkland. It would be nice to find his face on a video, for example. Yeah.
I think I saw him at Parkland, and I also saw him on two pictures in the corridor. Oh, it's on the third floor. The other day I was looking at it and I was like, oh, there's Seth Canner.
That would be a great one to circulate when you have the chance. Because the Seth Canner story should be verified once and for all. That would be great.
Well, it's a good book he wrote.
That was a great, that's one of the best books on the assassination, guys.
Yeah.
It really is.
Well, I just think that, you know, there's, you know, I know the 6-4 has, you know, their section of, you know, where people were. Like, you can go by and sign the guest book and things like that. But, you know, hearing stories like, you know, Meatloaf's, you know, story about where he was at a young age, you know, there's tons of people. There's thousands of people that have those kind of stories. And, you know, it's that going to tell us exactly what took place? You know, who killed JFK? No. But
it'd be nice to know if Phil Oakes was there, for example.
What's that?
Oh, there's a long-standing story. Jim Glover, you know, Phil Oakes' musical partner, claims that one photo portrays Phil. You know, now I don't think it's Phil, but hey, I didn't play music with him for 7 years like Jim did, you know?
Right.
I mean, it'd be nice to put that kind of stuff to rest, if possible.
Yeah. What the thing that I thought was really interesting, I mean, I didn't know his dad was a Dallas cop. You know, I mean, I had no idea about that until, you know, I started researching it. Like, this came out back in, you know, the mid-2000s when I found out that his dad was on the force. But, you know, when we went to, when me and Brian went down to the Dallas Public Library and started looking through the, you know, the police department yearbooks, we didn't see his photograph, but that doesn't mean that, you know, he wasn't, you know, on the force. I mean, there's no denying he was a police officer, you know, with Dallas, but just didn't see a uniform picture, and some police officers were not in the yearbooks or the you know, the roles. But you know, I just want to throw that out there. I mean, you know, there's obscure stuff, like I say, I like to call the obscure shit that, you know, kind of gives you sometimes just a little bit of a look into, you know, somebody else's opinion of what they saw or what they witnessed. I like to look at everything. So,
yeah, I've gone really visual, David, at this point in my life, and I want to see pictures. I don't want to read so many books anymore. I want to see the pictures, and that's why I'm so interested in Ted Gandolfo, because he had the most videotape of anybody. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm so interested in Robert Barrett, because from what I understand, you know, FBI agent Barrett had all the movies of 1230. He collected them. And that's one of the reasons I'm so suspicious of Barrett at this point, is anybody who had access to those knows more than anybody else. And why is some stuff missing? Why is some stuff not there? Barrett is the only one who can answer those questions. And, you know, he never did.
Barrett and Gerald Hill.
Yeah, I agree. Gerald Hill is another one.
Ben Bastard.
Yeah, Gerald Hill, I mean, we get down to who's doing the assassination. Hill's everywhere.
Yeah.
And so is Bart Odom, for that matter. On the FBI
I love it. Sorry, go on.
No, I was saying, between Bart Odom and Barrett and Hill, they're all in the theater, you know?
Yeah. I love the sprint of Hill in front of the Texas School Depository. They arrive just in front of it, and then there's a sprint
run
that is about 10, 12 feet, if that, and then he stops, and I go, you fat bastard, you can't even run, you just make it look like you're going in for it, and it's like, you stop already, you're like, oh, right, okay, and then hanging out the window, and go, yeah, come on, get forensic stuff here, it's like, oh, come on, and then he's in that video where they look in the library just after the Tippit murder, and they, You know, you see him in his white shirt running into this library when it's a false alarm or such. And again, well, when they come out with Oswald, he stands right on the opposite side, next to, I think it's next to Bentley. Again, he's in, he loves the image. And you know what? Bentley is as bad as he is because with the cigar in his mouth and just posing in front of the camera of Reed.
Yes, the head of the polygraph unit.
Yeah.
Well, what kills me about Hill, you see him on this dead run, like you say, I hear that's at 12:48. And then, according to William Allen, the photographer, he's up in the sixth floor shouting at 12:55. So if you do the math on that basis, which I have seen no reason to deny, that gives Hill 7 minutes between his arrival and finding the shells and leaning out the window.
Yeah.
And nobody covers that. And the reason why is because even 58 years later, we haven't studied this thing on a geo chrono basis, you know, minute by minute.
Yeah. I mean, the most important part on Hill, I found, was that document where he's with the film collections, KRLD, I think something like that, and he's part of that lot that basically keeps all this and stuff just, you know.
What's KRLD doing? Is this on the Ruby shooting?
Was it a predecessor for CBS or something like that, or an affiliate of CBS? And Hill, after Hill left the Dallas Police, and he worked for either that company or something related to it. And there was something, I'll have to look it up. I'll do that in a minute. But it was just like, oh, typical. You're in it as well.
But you know Hill's background. He worked for the amusement section for the newspaper. He covered the theater and all that stuff. And then he moved into being a police reporter, and he went so far as to working inside the cell block. He had his desk inside the cell block. He was that tightly tied with the cops. And finally, he joined the cops shortly before the assassination, and a month before the assassination, he joined Westbrook's little outfit. So, I mean, he's just a complete knave.
Hey guys, let me throw this out real quick, and I read it somewhere, but I'm not really sure. This is Casey. I think I read somewhere. Well, you know, you guys are talking about the time period when Hill runs up into the Texas School Book Depository building. I'm pretty sure it was Hill, but if I'm wrong, somebody correct me. Where he sprained his ankle and he couldn't walk for a little bit. But to me, when I'm watching him run and walk, it looks like he's doing pretty good. Hell, he'd have done pretty good in the football game the other night for L.A.
I heard the guys who sprained their ankle were Bentley and Casey Owens, and they were spraining their ankle running down from the balcony in the theater.
In the theater. Okay, that was it then.
Yeah. No, Hill, I think, got out unscathed. But Hill was also up in the balcony with Bentley and those guys. And I believe that's where the operation fell apart, because they were trying to kill Oswald, but he wasn't in the balcony like they thought.
Well, do you guys think that they were trying to kill him in the Texas School Book Depository building, too?
Absolutely, I do.
Yeah. Now, who do you think was supposed to do that?
I think Bentley and Hill and that crowd were the ones trying to do the hit. I don't know which one of them, but about 10 of them being busted through the back door like cowboys. And they ran into all those kids. And then they realized that they'd gotten the wrong tip, because that woman, Julia, had told him she thought he was in the balcony. And that was their belief system. And, and he wasn't there.
I wonder if that explains why the police started from the first floor up in their floor-by-floor investigation to give the other guys time to get to Oswald.
It's entirely probable, I think. If you think the people who ran it, like Lumpkin, were as crooked as I do, I think they were trying to buy time.
Yeah, because, I mean, if your tip is he's on the fifth or sixth floor, you would think everyone would go right up to that floor first. But they weren't.
Yeah. You'd at least have a team go up there, you know, and not give the bad guys time to make their escape. Yeah, that's crazy.
I just posted the Gerald Hill document in the chat. It is KRLD, so have a look at that.
I think, you know, the secret to this case in terms of investigation is nobody ever looked at it until we came along with the notion of cops being criminals. You know, they always looked at it from the other end of the spyglass. And when you start looking at the cops and the criminals, you come to very different conclusions. But you've got to be independent investigators to do that. You can't be government people.
No, that's true. Yeah, I agree.
So our work is still in front of us. far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's what I would like to do as a geochrono. I've done it to some degree, but not to the degree it needs to be done. That's when I realized I need video.
Well, I think what comes down to it, Bill, was back in 63, you know, I wasn't alive at that time, but I think the consensus was, you know, police officers, FBI, CIA, government, they're actually there to help protect us. They're not the bad guys. They're not the ones that are doing the, you know, the bad shit. They're the ones that are, you know, supposed to be, you know, truth, justice, the American way. Well, that's not exactly the way it was.
So they got infiltrated, just like most organizations get it.
Yeah, that day, I mean, we've heard the term, you know, we lost our innocence that day on November the 22nd. Well, yeah, because we were so damn naive about, you know, the protection about, you know, police departments and things of that nature. I'm not saying that all police departments are bad. I'm not saying all police officers are bad. I'm just saying,
of course not.
You know, you have some dark players, you know, so.
Here's another document that is on from Jack Ruby and Gerald Hill. Now, Gerald Hill was bragging about dating a stripper, so it'd be an interesting read. So I added that to it.
Hey Bill, sorry to interrupt, but I just downloaded the files from the new release, and again, they're not searchable. So this is something that I guess Rex and Mary Farrell are going to have to deal with in reposting, you know, those files. They're not searchable. Again,
yeah,
like
no, Rex makes them searchable. He gets them.
Right. You have to process them, of course. But you know, you would have thought that they would have done it, you know, in the dump, but they didn't, like they did before.
Yeah. Before. And when they do these dumps, they don't refer us back to the earlier documents to compare the differences. Right? I mean, it's a complete waste of time the way they do that shit.
Yeah, I'm curious to find out after, you know, they get through the full digitization, you know, the entire collection, if they get it done in 20 months, is it going to be searchable? Is it going to be the opportunity
It won't take too much time.
I don't think so either, but I think that, you know, by getting the collection, the full collection digitized, that's a great step in the right direction. But
yeah, then it's up.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's the role Rex could, you know, I think is going to give them some good advice, and hopefully, you know, they have four archivists dedicated to this project. Bill, what was, did we know what the budget is?
No, they never told us the dollars. But I think they're obviously plumping for a big budget if they want to get it done in 20 months.
Yeah, but to apply OCR technology to the documents so you can find them and so it recognizes it, it's very time consuming, you know, it needs to be done page by page, so it just doubles your workload.
It would be nice.
And that's why the Black Vault did it, for instance, they did that.
Yeah.
You know, they downloaded the documents, then they, the OCR technology to it as such, and therefore they became more searchable. But I find Google Drive handy because Google makes the documents searchable. The ones that I uploaded from Malcolm, they have been OCR'd as such. When I found that out, I was like, well, forget about it. I'm not spending time on that because that would just double my workload as such. So, and then I found that slowly it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it starts to look through everything that's related, whether it's a book or a document or an article as such, it all just gets found. If I just do Gerald Hill, like I've done now, I just find the bits and boom, you know, there you go. So I call it now. The only thing is that you have to look in the document. Now, most documents are 2, 3, 4 pages, so it's all doable. You're in shook when it's 300 pages. Then you should actually run it through Adobe Acrobat. Then you can do that. If you have Adobe Acrobat, there is other software as well. You just OCR it. And there's some of these apps that don't charge a thing.
It's the time constraint that we're, you know, it wastes time having to do all that. So
that's what it is. I mean,
and that's what they want, and it's by design, obviously.
Yes.
Well, I've done 150,000 odd pages. I spent almost 3 years on it. And if there are 7 million pages have been released, then it equals 2% of the collection. So. I don't want to depress everyone, but yeah, that is the reality, basically.
Well, as a matter of comparison, I did some work on the Malcolm X thing last year, when they came out with the new information that they're going to reopen the case, and I went into the FBI files, and all of the files are searchable. You know, you can go in there, plug in Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay, and get all kinds of documents, you know, because of the relationship that the two had. But you can't do this, obviously, with the JFK.
At some point, it will be done, and it will be available. It's just the question is when, because, you know, if you have people like Black Balls, you know, they just put their technology to fit that.
If they don't do that technology, are we still able to take those documents and then on our own make them searchable?
Yeah, you just grab the PDF and you just log the PDF in Adobe Acrobat and just say OCR. There's a menu on the right that pops out and goes, make document searchable. And then you just see it flashing through page to page.
Yeah, it indexes. It indexes the file, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Technology moves on, Lazar.
Yeah, and that's what Mary Farrell keeps doing with these documents, and Rex, and that's what, and Bill knows all about this.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. These documents are searchable.
Gotham in our country uses at least late 20th century technology, much less 21st.
Hey, David? Yeah, this.
Go ahead, Rex.
Yeah, I went back and I checked Meatloaf real quick. Bachelor had a rack-up that he did of everybody that worked in the Dallas Police Department. It's Commission Exhibit 5002, Simpicius. Bill, you're probably familiar with that. He covers everybody in every area. I didn't find it a day in there, so I don't know if his mother remarried. You know, I'm not sure if that's his birth name or what, but one thing that's interesting is the 20 guys that worked for Fritz, one of them was a guy by the name of Braulio Zapata.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. What a coincidence.
There are several things that catch your eye as you go through this list that I've earmarked over, you know, over the years, but that one was definitely an eye catcher.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is a picture of his dad. Mr. Ade. I can't remember exactly what his name was at the moment. It was Orvis Ade. Orvis Wesley Ade, that was his name.
Okay.
And
so the new guys, you know, the additions, recent additions are at the very end of the report, and Roscoe White is there on the last page. So, but I didn't see him in there. But.
Right. Well, like okay. That's the thing. I mean, I've been talking to Gary about it. You know, I know he was a cop. I just don't know. I mean, I know his mom died before his dad did. Then his dad died in 74, I believe is what the timeline is on that. But he died as I think he was a vacuum repair guy, had his own business, at the time of his death. So, you know, PD was, you know, sometime probably, you know, 50s, 60s, but, by the time the 74 happened, you know, he was in the ground. So, you know, it's one of the things where, you know, I don't have the whole chronological. I'd love to know if he was, you know, on the force prior to. Obviously, you know, Milo states the fact that he knew Jack Ruby, so then you got to look at the fact of time when Jack Ruby had the club, you know, when he knew him at that time, to kind of try to get a aspect of when he was, you know, when he was an officer. So,
did he say anything about Jack Ruby?
The only thing he said in the interview that I picked up on, you know, in the interview with Huckabee was, you know, his dad was a police officer. He knew Jack Ruby. They were acquaintances, but that's about as far as he goes into it. Now, if you go back and look at some of the documents or not documents, but stories that were written, in the mid 2000s, you know, he states the fact that's where I brought that deal that I read where he said that, you know, he knew it wasn't Oswald, but, you know, he'd been threatened, and that's all he was going to say. He wasn't going to talk about it.
I say,
well, what's the name of that guy you pointed us to a couple months ago who's done a whole new book about the witnesses? Do you remember who I'm talking about? He presented about 6 months ago, and he has a book for $35. It's a PDF.
Oh, Yeah, you're talking about the gentleman that made the maps.
Yes.
Ciccone.
Yes. I don't know how to reach him. Do you?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you go on to, I think, can we give me just a quick sec.
he just put a drop a text with his name, that would be great. I think his stuff's invaluable. I really think I would really recommend a lot of us get his stuff, or, you know, figure out a way to post some of his stuff.
Yeah, Craig Ciccone, that's who you're talking about. Let's see here.
Madonna's brother. He's got to share the same last name.
Okay, hold on. Yeah, if you click on if you go to the Project JFK website and click on the more affiliated websites.
Okay.
This is craigciccone.wordpress.com, all bunch of other, you know, the easiest way to find him is click on Craig Ciccone on the Project JFK website, but the master list of witnesses.
Yeah.
To the assassination, that book is there.
David, is that your girlfriend?
No, hell, I wish. let me see here. If they're, let's see, about, maybe this.
It's just a little hard to get his book. I remember I asked you once before, and you did try to help me, and I never was able to make the hookup.
Well, I tell you what, Bill, I will get a hold of, I've got Craig's number.
Oh, that'd be great.
I will get that to you, or call him up and tell him to give you a call. But I know that he did tell us that he was having some issues.
He was having issues, yeah.
You know, with the technical person, you know, that he is, he was having issues with getting up. I'm trying to figure out if nothing else that's why I put him on our website to get people to his site. But if he's having some issues, I'm going to see what I can do to, you know.
He was doing an upgrade, wasn't he?
Yeah, I remember he was going to do an upgrade.
And I looked at the fact of going, maybe there was a way that we could maybe even put him in, because I know that, you know, we're looking at I've been talking to Brian about changing our website a little bit to where we get an e-commerce part instead of where mostly I do it through email. They want, you know, something that we have for sale, then they email me direct, and then, you know, I can do the billing through PayPal and all. But it's easier to do it if you can order directly from the site, and I get that. It's just when you become an e-commerce site, the price of your website goes up substantially.
Oh, yeah. Goodness.
Yeah, you have to have a certificate and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Comparing to what we pay for our website that we have now and then going to e-commerce, it usually will bump it up anywhere between 3 to 4 times what you're paying for just an information site. Like
that's so sad. Yeah.
It is.
Well, well, thank you for the heads up. Yeah.
But yeah, I will definitely, I'll reach out to Craig and have him give you a call, and that
thank
way
you
can get a hold of it. So.
Appreciate it.
Did Huckleby, I assume he just gave Meatwolf softball questions? He didn't kind of follow up on anything?
Well, I mean, it was basically kind of a, you know, what was nice about it is it was an interview where he did a lot of interruptions. He basically just kind of let Meatwolf tell a story, you know? Now, one of the people that he talks about, his best friend, I looked up, you know, I did the research and looked up the name, and the only person I could find, and he is down in around Dallas, Texas area. He runs a printing service. So I'm going to reach out to him and just say, hey, I'm a researcher, Prodigy FK. You know, I saw the interview with Meatloaf on Huckabee, and I've been following it for the last 15, 20 years. You were there. You know, providing this is the same person, you know, and it could be a junior, I don't know. From what I've found out so far, I think it's the same person that Meatloaf talks about. But, you know, kind of get his side of the story, what he remembers too, you know, so.
It would be great, yeah, it would be great to be able, maybe nowadays he'll be a little more comfortable sharing.
Right, exactly.
Hey, David, what high school did he go to? Do you remember offhand? He was 16 at the time.
Well, I think he was 14. Let me see here. I know he talks about it I think he talks about it in the video.
Yeah, he was born in 47, so September, so he's 16.
16, okay. Well, I know one of them, I think one of them was 14 in the group or something, but I know they were all on the football team together.
I wonder if he was an Oak Cliff boy, just out of curiosity.
I don't think it was Oak Cliff. I know,
hey,
well, here's the thing.
Wayne,
I know he went back and actually gave...
You might want to take your noontime pills. Right there.
Let's see. Here we go. He was...
right here.
Yeah, I don't see it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. see. Yeah, September 27, 1947. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School. And I know that just, I think it was a couple years ago, or maybe it was just this past year, but he actually went back to, you know, his high school and spoke there. And then, he attended college at, Lubbock Christian College and then transferred to, North Texas State University. I mean, interesting guy, but yeah, definitely.
I asked the question because Danny Arce, Arnold Rowland, and Roy Milton Jones, who was on the Marsalis bus, all went to Crozier Tech, so I was just kind of curious.
Okay.
Joe Molina did that as well, went to Crozier.
Correct.
In the end, it's a small world, that whole Dallas thing, if you just look at the education part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, 2 days ago, I happened to be in a building where I talked to this one secretary, and she was about 75 years old. And we were talking, and she was from she grew up in New Orleans. And I said, well, then you were old enough to understand what happened with JFK. And she goes, oh, good God, yeah. And she said, you know, she goes, I was a sophomore in high school, and when we got word that Kennedy was killed, and she said people started clapping and laughing and carrying on, and she got so upset that she ran down to the principal's office and said, I want to go home. And the reason, you know, he says, why do you want to go home? Because she said, I'm going to punch somebody out. And I'm sitting there going, holy cow. But I said, well, are you sure you weren't in Dallas? Because I have heard stories over and over again where the kids were screaming and yelling and clapping. But, you know, I think part of that is the mentality of the society that we lived in at that time, that a lot of people basically thought JFK was what a lot of his generals thought of him. They thought he was chicken shit. And
as Elma Moore said to Jim Goschenour, Jim didn't say this on the Stone movie, that his father was an appeaser and Kennedy himself was a traitor.
Yes. Okay.
There's a picture when which was shot after Ruby shot Oswald, and it's right opposite the building on the. It's where the where Mark Bell stood, that area, and all the others right in front of it, in front of the plaza on Houston Street, and they were cheering and smiling and stuff like that, just on the news that Ruby had shot Oswald as such. Strange, because you know what, you are also, I don't know, how do I say this eloquently, like, you know, you're for the Constitution and so forth, this, that, and the other, and I think that's just so anti-constitutional in the first place, not believing proper justice and so forth, but to them was proper justice.
Because he was going to get, you know, the penalty in those days was the death penalty, so people just felt, you know, he got the penalty. He just got it before wasting time for a trial. That's how they
felt. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're also looking, too, you're also looking at the psychology of society, too.
Right.
I know I went back and asked my mom. I mean, I saw Ruby shoot Oswald on TV, and I was, 13 years old at the time. I didn't quite understand it because it happened so fast, but I'm sitting there going, okay. I mean, we don't have replays. You guys know, most of you guys know that you didn't have it at that time. But when you saw it again, you're sitting there going, my God, did I just see something? And my mom did, and she sat there, and she goes, my God, he got what he deserved.
Right.
And years later, I would go back and ask my mom, and she says, don't psychoanalyze me. You know, you got a minor in psychology. And I said, Mom, I just want to find out why you said that. And she says, are you going to profile all of society and mirror image me on this? And I said, yes, I am. I forgot.
Well,
I mean,
I'm here to tell you, Casey, I was 12 years old. I saw it on TV. And I was cheering and yelling. I was so happy. Frontier justice had prevailed. And I turned to my parents, who were both Republicans. They were like, this is very bad. And I couldn't understand why they weren't as excited and happy as I was.
Well, yeah, I mean, remember, I mean, again, we're going back to most people felt the FBI and the police, you know, really didn't, you know, charge people that were not really guilty. I mean, that, you know, there are some parts of society that feel that way. But for the most part, you know, these were patriotic people doing their duty. There was no doubt that they would not have arrested Oswald unless they thought, you know, he was the guy who did it. And that's the way a lot of people felt. And there's a lot of shows on TV, right? We had a lot of Westerns in those days.
Well, also, I mean, if Trump got killed today, I think a lot of people would be yelling and screaming and cheering, too. I mean, I think we're a very polarized society and always have been.
Yes, and, well, we can go off on a tangent about 1941 and 40, but yes, we voted.
Yeah, with FDR.
Yeah.
My dad told me the way they would attack Eleanor Roosevelt. But the photographer is always trying to show a picture of her with her hand next to her nose, so it would look like she was picking her nose.
I had a professor in college who was a functioning alcoholic, and we went on a field trip one time, and he got up on a stool in a bar in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and said how his lifelong ambition was to go piss on Roosevelt's grave.
Well, God, there's a man who needs a wife. Yeah.
But if any of you are interested in World War II, there was a great program on C-SPAN last week, and it just made me realize how bad we were divided then when he said they had a whole what-if panel. And the what-if panel was, what if the Japanese had only attacked the Philippines and the South, you know, and the Gulf, the Dutch, whatever those islands were, and Hitler never declared war on us because there was no attack in Pearl Harbor, what would have happened? And they said Roosevelt was hard-pressed to get Congress to pass a declaration of war because there were so many isolationists, and Roosevelt was really, you know, he was looked at as an evil man.
You know what that was called? It was called the cash and carry system for the Brits as well. Basically, the British needed arms.
Yeah,
so they said, you can get the arms, but you come and collect them, and you buzz off, and that's that. That's basically it. That's what it was called, cash and carry.
Program.
Yeah, we called it lend and lease. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, that's interesting. And that was, of course, very dangerous for the English to take their ships across the Atlantic, go to the States with the risk of the Nazi U-boat. And so they basically had twice the risk, basically, first to go there and then coming back loaded up with guns and getting attacked by the Germans again.
Or the Americans. We've got plenty of fascists here in America. I mean, Dulles was an operating fascist. So was Angleton. You know, and these people were classic fascists. And, you know, they're all through our government as well. I mean, Trump is a classic fascist.
We gave you a lot of ships, too, Bart. We got a lot of destroyers in World War One. We, you know, the Fletcher and those guys we sent.
Not me, because I'd still have them in action if I did get them. And by the way, one more thing. I'm not British. All right? Don't ever make that mistake
again. Yeah, you don't want to do that.
No, exactly. I'm Dutch. So there you go. The genie's out of the bottle now, Lazar.
But how long have you been living in England?
28 years.
So you're English now.
No. Actually, I could get a passport, but the Dutch are so pedantic that they basically say, if you want to get an English passport, you'll have to lose your Dutch one. So, and I was like,
get a green card, you come into New York City, you'll be able to vote. You don't have to be a citizen anymore to vote in New York City. Crazy.
Thank God. I mean,
hey, Bart,
in a small town right here.
Hey, Bart, I got to tell you something. I saw that hour, a little over an hour interview that you and Malcolm did. I saw the very beginning. And I sat back and I'm going, who the hell is that sitting next to Malcolm Blunt? And I had to look and I kept looking and I'm going, God dang, I know that guy from somewhere. Damn, you clean up good. I could not believe it. So I wanted to say, do we have to get a camera in front of you all the time? But I'm telling you what, you did a hell of a job on that.
Well, thank you. I mean, the thing is that Malcolm and I decided, and Malcolm was most happy with it. I said, I'm just going to do loose talks. I said, I'm not going to come in with like, what about such and such and this and what happened on this event and blah, blah, blah. First of all, this archive spans 25 years of research and it's in three sections, basically. There's the Dallas stuff, the Miami stuff, and then of course the spook stuff. And, if I start talking to Dallas stuff, he's a bit forgetful and I really have to warm him up beforehand. So, and the thing is now I've realized all I do is say one word or one sentence and I just let him rip and it just, and he does the talking as such. Slowly we basically went through that. I am going to go back to a really interesting part next year. I'm going to have an interview about the Dallas, the photography of the Dallas police evidence and the FBI. He wrote an article about it in 1999, and even then, he only had six scenarios of what could have happened, basically just on the dating of the files. Los Federales have made an absolute stinking pile of mess regarding the evidence on the films as such. There are many missing pages, photographs of these pages, and said that the camera malfunctioned. And this was an idiot-proof camera. You know, it's one of those that's just mounted on a board, and you just press the shutter, and you just wind it, and you press the shutter again, you know, and just move the document and so forth. And the stupidest thing is that, by the looks of it, from what I've seen so far, is that it just happens in the middle of the film. It just doesn't happen at the end or at the beginning or what or not. So there's absolutely no logical reason for that camera basically to get buggered and then basically just continue with what it was doing as such, and then all of a sudden the pictures are on there. So most probably they basically got rid of or wanted to Steve Six evidence that was uncomfortable to explain as such. Let me keep it light, but yeah, there's going to be maybe the interviews I did now was for the archive just to release and slowly warm up, and I did it from July till early November. And it's a good laugh because when I go to Malcolm, I stay there for about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 hours. So we just kill time and just say, oh, you know what, let's do another interview. We'll just chat, because normally we just talk backwards, forwards, left, right, whatever direction it takes us. And that's too wishy-washy and just too much all over the place. So we just try and look at one subject and, you know, I didn't know you had talked to Robert Gemmelin, for instance, and he speaks about that in the last...
What's his Miami stuff, Bart? What has he got on Miami?
Cuba. Just Cuba.
Not Cuba. The mob. Anti-Castro activists. Does he do the anti-Castro activists much?
Some of it. He's done... There's bits on the CRC, and there's bits on... You just go to the archive, the link that I gave you, and just go to Cuba. Yeah. And, you know, and I found out at some point that 98% is already at NARA. I think Rex Bradford has got an absolute wicked collection when it comes to anti-Castro bits. So that is just the bit where, so a lot of times I didn't have to scan. I had whole entire folders that were like an inch and a half thick, and it was like, and I just checked all the lists, and it was all online already. So I was like, you know, I forget that. I don't have to scan that in. But that was definitely, that subject is best covered by Rex Bradford's website.
All right. Well, good to know. But I'd like to see the little bits that he's got that Rex does not. That would be good.
Yeah. There's quite a fair amount of stuff that I threw in it. And I thought the spook documents regarding assassination plans and so forth, they were quite an interesting read. You know,
good.
So yeah, there's a fair amount. You know, this archive, I haven't been really going through it for the last month, and I feel liberated. But I'm not kidding, man. You know, when you scan documents in every hour of the day, like 12 hours a day for 6 or 7 days a week, then you know, just not having to do it. Although I know I've got 7 bags about an hour's drive away waiting to be done. But, you know, when they're in my house, I'm like, yeah, let's get it over and done with. But now, out of sight, out of mind. So that's what they say in Britain. It's like, brilliant. So I'm like, forget about it. So don't touch them until February or March. I want to finish my papers first. they deserve to be released after all that time. So, and then I've got a bunch of Harry Livingston stuff as well still to be done.
I'm looking forward to seeing that Harry Livingston. Yeah. He was a great researcher.
It's fantastic. I mean, he's a bit of a conspiracy nut, but at the same time, I've never seen anyone be so tenacious and driven when he makes phone calls. So I've got a ton of audio. He called every one of the doctors and the nurses in Parkland and in Bethesda.
Well, that'll be the movie that needs to be made. I don't think we're ever going to see that other movie. I saw it once. It's one of the best movies I've ever seen on the case, and they deep sixed it.
You know what? Yeah, back in the 90s, from what I've read, you've got these guys like Lifton, Grodin, Livingston, who were in competition that just wasn't healthy at all anymore. It was just really deeply divisive. And then when Grodin and Livingston were going to do a movie together, and then Grodin went to Oliver Stone and helped him on the movie, that whole plan of doing those two doing the movie together got deep sixed. And a serious amount of paranoia came between the correspondences, especially, I've got to give it that Livingston was quite paranoid, but on the other hand, rightly so, from what I've all read from his personal correspondence as such. I've got 10 bags in the attic that I've, some of it I've scanned, some of it I haven't, and I've said this before, I'm trying to do a project medical related, hopefully next year at some point, but it will be later in that year. And I've got wicked sketches, absolutely amazing sketches of the wounds and you know, like a skull and then basically plastered over, drawn in, but you see that it's sandwiched with JFK's head to basically point to the impact from the holes and stuff like that.
Do you study Tink Thompson's analysis part? Do you think Tink got it right in his new book?
I haven't read the book, but from the documentary that I saw,
yeah,
I thought some of the stuff was really, really good. And, you know, you combine that with, say, Bill Newman's evidence and witness statements that quick after the event as such, then you go, yeah, of course, there was somebody.
Well, you see the two blood spatter lines that...
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the best evidence there is.
Yeah, that's really neatly laid out. It's really simple and to look at. And
yes,
I mean, about the actual position, I think he's more right than what they think about Badge. Man, my God, what a bunch of fakery! It's so bad. I think he's right about the position. Kurt Marcus did the same thing. He pointed also to that same person on that position near that tree. Kurt Marcus basically made the best copies of the Mormon photo as such. And I think Robin Unger has a really good, I think that's a copy of the drum roll scan that Thompson has. Thompson made a drum roll scan of the particular Polaroid that it's about 3,000, 4,000 pixels wide. So just go to jfkassassinationgallery.com. And
really knocked it out of the park. I think one buddy of mine said it was like sneaking one past the goalie. I think if that Thompson biography gets widely circulated, more people are going to understand this case better than most researchers do.
I got a quick question about I haven't seen Tink's new film yet, but the shot to the head, where does it impact the skull?
Oh, well, there's two head...
I mean the one from the front. I'm sorry, the frontal shot that hits the skull.
Oh, right above the right ear on a tangential angle. He thinks it's from the grassy knoll.
Okay. What about the hole above the right eye? Is that an exit? Then it's what he thinks is what he proposes.
No, well, I don't think so.
He thinks that's part of the shatter from the ear injury.
Bill Newman said that he was hit in the temple as such, and so did Malcolm Kiddo. So. It's roughly around here.
Yeah.
Although I'm in there. This is my right. Yeah. So that right there. And that, you know, that in combination with the photographs and stuff like that, yeah, it's It's a very good thing. What I really liked was the picture he had of the, what was that, that tower? And, what's his name? What's the guy's name who died
Bowers?
In the...
Lee Bowers?
Yeah.
Lee Bowers, yeah.
Lee Bowers, so, but I'm thinking, I'm looking at that and go, mate, you see much, much more of what you actually attest to. So he just kept quiet because just that picture, and the picture was taken in 66. So I don't know how much trimming and all that was what, but even then, the distance and the area you could look at, you're like, get the fuck out of here. It's so obvious that he saw what was happening over there, you know, as such. It was just unexplainable. So
yeah, he said he saw four people, right? Two over by the fence line that ran along Elm, and then two over by the entrance to the parking area, and those guys were in uniform. So he accounts for four people back there.
Yeah.
I really think the ABC guy did an incredible job. It's only 80 minutes long.
Yeah.
And there's dozens of interviews in it. There's just no fat in it. You know, it's an example.
That's a really good description.
Be done.
It just goes on and on, and it just pounds, and it doesn't stray off subject, even though there's a lot of different things going on as such.
It doesn't right. feel as rushed as Stone's movie. It just seems to go, it's like Tink's personality just kind of lays it out, and it feels like you're not being rushed.
Yeah, Tink doesn't go into many topics, and so it really lends a strength.
Yeah, the position, being precise, you know, that's it for me all about. I mean, I look at other research and stuff like that, but I'm going that far with my interests, whereas everything else, I'm going that far. So it's like, you know, but I don't agree with everything he says, but it was just a really solid and a really fluid documentary as such. Because I find most documentaries really crap because they try to cram too much stuff into 90 minutes. They go, well, it has to be 60 or 90 minutes. And we have to do this, that, and the other. And everything is summarized. You don't really feel that it's concise. Because, and there is that documentary. I thought that was very good. I've got an issue with the Stone one. It's all over the place, you know. I don't need to know about Africa and about Lumumba and this, that, and that, all the other world events that were happening as such. And I know in a bigger picture, yes, though I wouldn't have put that in a 2-hour version. I would have put that in four.
And in the bigger picture is going to obviously include that little bone that he has about Vietnam. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's crazy.
But that's Jim DiGiorno.
Oh, it's Jim's story. It's Jim's story, definitely.
Yeah. He wrote the script, so it's his influence.
Yeah, it is a Jim DiGiorno film, that's for sure.
It is.
Yeah. I mean,
I think Jim did a good job, despite my various disagreements with him. I think he did a fine job boiling it down in 2 months. I thought it was really smart to do the evidence first and really just hit you upside the head over and over again with photos and stills. And then, you know, the last 40 minutes get into the why part.
He had two different narrators, which helps to...
What do you think about the Policarpio angle there, which I thought was very weak, all right? Very speculative. And
which one's this, Larry?
The Policarpio with the Tampa plot. You know, they did very well with the Chicago, but when they... flipped over to Tampa, I mean, the information is not corroborated at all. The documents are very weak. I have all those. And, you know, that was a very, very weak part of the presentation.
Well, let me ask you, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I thought there were interesting analogies that Waldman drew between Oswald and the Purple. No, not Valley. No, but the fella in Tampa who was at the November 17th.
Right, the Cuban,
It just looked like he was being set up as a possible patsy based on time and space, you know, fair play for Cuba. Then he crosses the border on the 22nd, then he flies back to Cuba. I mean, he could have been set up, and it wasn't convenient because of Tampa, nothing happened.
No, as supposedly the only passenger on that Cubana Airlines flight on the 27th.
Yeah, so. I mean, he was Angleton's guy. Angleton always blamed Policarpo. He said, he's the guy who did it.
Casey.
Well, there you go.
Casey, what did you try to say?
Oh, I'm going to ask for everybody who hasn't seen the Tink's video or his documentary, what is the name of that?
JFK Unsolved.
Yeah. I put the link. It's in the chat. I put a link. Okay. It's on YouTube. And then put it on full screen because it's very crisp.
And Casey, this is Bob. That video has also been made available along with a bunch of others and a link you'll find in the chat.
Okay.
I put a whole bunch of videos there, including Revisited.
The good thing about that film is just it keeps you interested. And it's not a slow moment there. Like, you know, it's fast paced. And yet it just, you know, goes in quite little other directions. And the new interviews on top of that I thought was also a good thing. My issue with the Stone documentary is that it's 15 years late. That's my problem.
Right. Right.
That's a good point.
And there's a major mistake when he says 2029. It wasn't 2029. It was 2039. You know, I don't know where, you know, they came up, you know, and revised that to 2029. I wasn't aware of that. I'm pretty certain that it was 2039. And
well, yeah, he's getting his document release mixed up. One was on the Warren Commission, which was 2039, and the other one is House Senate Select Committee, which is 2029.
It was originally 2029, and then it got changed.
In that era, 75 years was for the Warren Commission, and then there was a congressional rule about 50 years.
Yeah, the House Select Committee was originally 50 years, and then it got moved to 2017.
Right, right. You can see that if you read the testimony of David Bellin. And the archivist in the Bella Abzug hearing, which is again fascinating, where he admits that the Warren Commission improperly classified, they had no authority to classify.
They had no authority.
But that's like the Rockefeller Commission was expressly given the authority in the executive order creating it to, you know, in other words, there's an executive. So when the president issues these executive memos about national security, and then what happens is they create like an agency and commission, and they're then said to be subject to that order, and therefore they can classify. That was not done with the Warren Commission, but Ford did it with the Rockefeller Commission. And Biden, I mean, Bellin goes into that. It's a really great, you know, explanation. It's just too bad that transcript has not been made publicly available. I mean, I've shared it in the past, but.
You know what you could do is, why don't you send it to Rex? He'll post it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the way to get it more out there.
I was thinking about writing an article about how the Warren Commission improperly, you know.
Yeah, write the article and he'll run both.
Yeah.
Rex is really good at it. He can do that in a minute, you know.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
He supported me with the, blunt documentation, so not a bad word about Rex. So,
no, you might want to consider collaborating with him on some stuff.
I mean, it was the general counsel of the Warren Commission that just took it upon himself, and he instructed the court reporters that these materials are to be classified. And what Bellin's position was that, so they're reviewing documents that are classified, and they didn't have their clearance yet. It was a joke amongst the staff about how could these documents be classified.
It's the same as the Rankin papers. They're exempt from the JFK Records Act. I know someone who's got them. Now, the thing is, everyone wrote to Rankin. Okay?
Yes.
So if they had any misgivings or anything like that, they're off. They wrote to Rankin.
Well,
I don't see anything in the act saying that Rankin's papers are exempt. How did that happen?
I don't know, but Malcolm has had his hands on it, and I know someone else has got them, and I hope he's going to send them to me because I'm going to digitize the whole lot.
Well, that's fantastic.
But big box like that, and then the beauty of these papers is that they express themselves without thinking, oh, that's going to come out, or that's going to get published, and so forth. In the Warren Commission folder, from the Warren Commission folder I've got in the Blunt Archives, there are loads of documents with annotations from whoever you can think of who say, well, isn't that too speculative and this, that, and the other? What about the rifle and blah, 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 this, that, and the other? All the so-called annotations.
Oh, that's gold. Marginalia.
Hold on, guys. Hold on.
I can't believe you haven't even gone into that folder yet.
No,
but, yeah.
There are plenty of memos out there to Rankin that are publicly available. It would be his papers where he may have had some writings, but there are tons of memos out there. And then also when, what's his name? We Will Be Absolved. Willens, when he did his book, he actually had posted on the website all of his memos that he had gotten. So there's plenty of stuff out there. There may be
Howard Willens, right?
They were called private papers, so that's why they were exempt.
It makes me think about Flossen. Donald Flossen is still alive, who was one of the staffers who listened to the Oswald tape after the assassination. You know, interviews are not really my thing, partially because I'm a lawyer and I'm trained never to be a witness. But anybody who likes doing interviews, I could probably help get an interview with Flossen if anybody's interested.
Really?
Yeah.
But you have to.
I might just do that because I've got his handwritten notes and so forth.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think he's at the point now where he'd be willing to do an interview. He did one for Phil Shannon.
Is he about 90 years old now?
He's not quite that old. He's in his 80s.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know who I would love to talk to, although he will say me absolutely nothing, is Elmer Boyd. I saw an article.
There you go.
He's 92, 93 years old. So, and there was a newspaper article, where he's basically posing for a picture, and it was Arlington something newspaper, and that was a year ago, and it was
yeah the birthday was, party every year down there.
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
yeah. No, you
came to visit and go. What did you do? Did you actually find that ticket on that bus ticket in his pocket or not? You know,
just to let you know. Bard and Bill, they were, according to Bellin, they were supposed to not keep any of their own, they were supposed to turn everything over to the Warren Commission. There was no private records supposed to be kept. Some people kept some, like Willens and I guess Rankin, but for the most part, the staff were supposed to turn everything over. So to the extent that there are some records, they're probably duplicative, but it's the senior guys are the ones that may, you know, obviously kept stuff because of their position, but the staff were not supposed to keep anything.
Bill, you need to ask him if you get an interview. You need to ask him whether he still has papers left. Because Malcolm finds it really strange that certain people's papers weren't part of the collection as such. So.
Well, and so they were not. So what happens is people keep these records, and no one the. Archives doesn't know the commissioners themselves were not subject to the JFK Act, so you know unless they knew to ask, they wouldn't ask them for the papers. The staffers weren't supposed to keep anything. It's supposed to, you know, so that's why, you know, I doubt there's anything usable at the staff level.
I think everybody keeps as much as they can. Nobody gets punished for it. Willens didn't get punished. He printed all the stuff.
Oh, because he was a senior guy, so that's I'm saying the senior guys kept stuff.
They were allowed to keep stuff.
Well, you know, they were in charge, so they did what they want.
I'll tell you another person of interest is from the whole Warren Commission is Alfreda Scooby.
Yeah,
the name that isn't there.
Yeah.
There was a guy on that Quiro, whatever that listserv, and he. There was a question, did any of the Warren Commission, you know, members disagree with the single bullet theory? And I wrote, yeah, with Russell, Cooper, and Boggs. And then they said, well, Russell was a racist. And I said, well, the fact he's a racist has nothing to do with his opinions about the Warren Commission. Well, he only attended 12% of the meetings. I said, yeah, but Alfreda Scobie was there, and she kept him informed, and she wrote some really good memos. And she wrote a great article in 65. Apparently, I think when the ARB went to talk to her, she was at that point, you know, she was old and didn't remember too much.
And I'd love to see an interview happening with Betsy Wolf. You know, that would be so awesome to read.
That would probably be pretty easy, I would think.
No. She don't want to talk about it. So, Malcolm has a really impressive collection of Betsy Wolf documentation. He's in love with her handwriting.
Why do you think Betsy's so important? I've read a lot of her stuff, but
she did everything on the agency for the HSCA. And she wrote all those reports that were all classified, and they all started coming out, and Malcolm got his hands on it. But Malcolm is also a bit in love with her handwriting because it's really beautiful. It's a very nice, curly handwriting in these. You recognize it immediately. Once you start looking at all these documents, and then all of a sudden, Betsy Wolf. Just one of a kind. You just pick it out and go, yeah, that's Betsy Wolf. You don't even have to put her name on it.
But besides the good handwriting, what about her analysis is so good?
Well, from what I know, it's just that she touches subjects that others didn't.
Okay.
Especially when it comes to the agency. And she dug into things when it comes to agency related. And, you know, that's Malcolm's primary source of interest, just finding out about who said what and who did what. And she basically is very good at that. That's why all that stuff went just basically put behind closed doors. So, and Malcolm has got about, physically, I'm not kidding, like a computer screen height, basically, on paper, and it's all Betsy Wolf. And it's all agency related as such. So, you know, it's gold to Malcolm. So I'm just going to post a link for Malcolm's archive in one more time as such. In that folder, in the documents folder, there's also Wagoner Carr. And Wagoner Carr got a lot of documentation when it comes to Ruby and the Dallas police. And I've come across some things where I just didn't know that was there and didn't know that was there. There's a lot of pages. I think it's something between 8,000 and 10,000 pages. And they come originally from the Wagoner Carr archive, but Gordon Winslow got hold of this. These were microfiche rolls, 16 millimeter rolls. And I had these digitized with one of these old fashioned machines, and guy did it for me in the west of England, and they're just four or five or six giant PDFs, anything from 1500 to 4,500 pages, and that was really cool because I contacted those archives before, and they said we can only give you 10% from each folder, and I was like, what kind of bollocks is this? You know, just saying that, and just like I get 10% out of each folder. That's what they'll allow to digitize. And I'm going, well, how do I get the other 90%? You get like a shrug of the shoulders style reply as such. And then when Malcolm mentioned, like, no, I've got here the JFK stuff from Wagoner Carr, and I was like, yeah, I'll have that. I'll get that digitized and such. And he gave them to me 3 or 4 years ago. But yeah, that's really that's a lot. I'm just still going through it. Once I've got a bit of time off browsing through it.
I see Wagoner Carr, but you know, Betsy isn't up yet, I take it.
No, Betsy's in HSCA, going to HSCA. Back to the main route. The thing works like a Windows directory. So the CIA writes to the HSCA. So in the CIA folder is an HSCA folder. But in the HSCA folder is also a CIA folder. So when Blakey writes to Breckenridge, you get those. And then from Breckenridge to Blakey, you get the returns and so forth. It's not 100%. It's still a work in progress, but that's how it's going to work. And on top of that, the search engine is very good. So just type in a name. And if it's there, if it's mentioned inside, right there.
So how bad an actor do you think Breckenridge was? I think every time I see him, the less I like him.
He's a POS. So, he did his best to basically suppress and stall and so forth. And it was Blakey, you know, where are the documents? Where's this? Where's that? You know, blah, blah, blah. And then he comes back, well, we have to get the vet to get it through this, do that. So this person needs to be decided and so forth. And, you know, it's just cat and mouse game between two heavyweights during the HSCA and so forth. You've got the same thing with Helms. And the and the Warren Commission, I think it is Rankin. Yeah, it's Rankin and Helms to talk to each other as such. There's a whole lot of things. But that needs to be fine-tuned as such. I just started doing that whole thing in the course of this year when I was already 2 years in. So certain things need to be sorted out. But the good thing is the OCR works. It doesn't differentiate with any of that. So anything, just when I put Gerald Hill in, I get all kinds of stuff, basically. From
you know the Kent Pollock with Sam Halpern, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. For the That's a great little item, that Kent Pollock. Looking at it.
Yeah, some of the stuff is absolutely great. I mean, it doesn't matter what the beauty of that archive is. It's like Weisberg's archive. It doesn't differentiate. It doesn't specify, oh, I'm only doing the medical stuff or only doing the CIA stuff. It just got, it's got loads and lots of stuff. So the beauty of I'll tell you, but I can't show you. But with the medical stuff, for instance, well, Livingston had all these folders basically aimed per person and that he spoke to. If he saw, if there's two people involved in that particular document or whatever it was, book chapter, he would make two copies, so one in each person that was mentioned as such. And Malcolm's system, I created a different system, which is basically like based on Weisberg's archive, because I thought that archive left the best impression on me of organizing things. I don't give a damn about riff numbers because it doesn't really say what it's about as such. Whereas if I take a name in and the name is electronically stored, then I get everything related to it, no matter where it is at and so forth. Take that search element out of it, so it's just the technology that basically picks up on that as such. It only doesn't work when the copy of the actual document is rubbish. And that happens in the off chance that it's a dirty document. That's what I call it, basically, when the tone's making it too difficult for the words to come out as such. And then Malcolm goes like, yeah, that's how it was given to me. So, you know. And the other thing is that basically if you want to search, you can do that, but you can also just go, like if you were going through my documents folder on the Windows PC and look at all the subfolders as such. Because the good thing about that is that it gives you ideas of names. You go, oh yeah, I forgot about that and this, that and the other. And then you go, okay, let me put that name in so I can search. It's like a double-edged sword. And that seems to work pretty well. So I haven't heard anyone bitching, so that's the beauty of it all. So people do seem to get through it and get stuff they actually want. So, and that's a good thing. And yeah, and there's going to be more added, but not until March, April. Then I'll start again, do things. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're almost at the 3-hour mark. Does anybody else have anything they'd like to add or talk about? This is our, of course, this is our final meeting, our final show of the year. But we will be coming back strong and heavy in January with the Journey meeting and also another Spotlight Series presentation. I know before we close, I want to thank everybody for all the hard work that you have done this year, what you are continuing to do, and being a supporter of what we do here at Project JFK CSI Dallas, and join us on our programs and conferences. Monthly presentations, the Spotlight Series, and also joining in our Journey meetings, because we talk about a lot of great stuff here. Mm. Let's see.
It's good to share all the information. I mean, you know, get new leads and ideas and so forth, and that's important. You know, I mean, it's different. This differs from Deep UK. There's much more hunting going on here, and this. You know, of course, the States is a better hunting ground. I hope to come to the States the 22nd. Before, that's two memos before the one that they talk about in the JFK documentary. And well, that is purely for protection.
But didn't Hoover write his before, Hoover wrote his before Katzenbach, right? He said that we have our man.
No, Katzenbach said it at 4 o'clock. It's in my investigations paper. And Katzenbach basically talks about... if Oswald is the right guy, then we need to come out as quickly as possible. And that's just purely like damage prevention of the world screaming all of a sudden, go, we must attack, and give basically the John Cheese stuff the ammo they actually need as such. Well, they just wanted to kill that whole Russia idea off as quickly as possible.
The point is to bring this back to the current generation that, again, we always try to say, why should the current generation be interested in this topic? Because when we were kids, the Kennedy assassination would be equivalent to World War One, right? We viewed World War One as purely historical. That's what they view it. So unless we can bring some relevance.
Well, history keeps repeating itself. So, you know, that's the thing. We always fall on the same trap.
It rhymes. It doesn't repeat itself. We have to show how this is rhyming, you know, today. But
here, I'll give you something real quick. I come home from work the other day and I walk in. It's about 5:30 and I'm getting ready to watch the news, whichever flip of the coin of the news I'm going to watch. But all I see on there is a map of the geopolitical map of the United States, and I see the red states, and I see all the other states, and the red states are all southern states. And I look at this, and I'm going, they must be talking about the Civil War. And I turn the damn thing up, and I'm going, shit, they're talking about the idea of masking, the idea of where the viruses are going, and I'm sitting there going, holy cow, are we headed back to that now? But, I mean, are we heading back to the idea of, at least in the United States, the states are going to reign supreme? And I know, Larry, you mentioned something about that at the very beginning, but the states remain supreme over the federal government, or does the federal – I mean, I know that's the separation of powers and stuff, but I'm sitting there going, whoa. I don't want to see this because this looks like it could be a war coming up. But I don't think anybody in the United States would go to war because they're all chicken shit.
Well, the left has gotten much more aggressive.
No, it's not separation of powers. It's a question of federalism.
Yes.
And, you know, remember, so, you know, the southern states, they always felt there was this right of nullification of the federal government. So there's history here. Every generation tends to deal with it. It's all about the role of the federal government versus the role of the states. If the Constitution was written today, we probably would have a very different Constitution. But it was written in the 1700s and, you know, the states were sovereign. It's like the EU right now. So there is an effort in the EU to kind of make the state, the individual countries less than sovereigns. And have the EU be the governing law.
That was the pet hate of the British.
The what?
That's the pet hate of the British before they voted for Brexit. Basically, they said, we have people making decisions over us, for us, who we haven't voted for.
I want to circle back. David, there's a couple things that, just to circle back, we still want to see if we can get someone from to contact the daughters, the Oswald daughters. We'd like to try to bring that, court of inquiry petition to try to, expunge Oswald's arrest. So I know Brian in the past has had some contact, so that's something we'd like to do.
Okay.
I think we want to explore someone contacting the Kennedy family about trying to release those transcripts. At some point we may have to sue the Kennedy family, for the tapes that Bobby took because they're technically assassination records. But those are kind of things that, and there may be some others that Bart has ideas about, but we need to kind of focus on some people to get some information. I don't want to get us distracted that, you know, that there's still things that we need to do while people are alive. I'd like to see if we can get Marina to grant, you know, to let us leave the IRS records. She has the power to release them. So three things that maybe the noodle over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, you know, I think there's still definitely work to do, and what you just mentioned, we need to figure out who would be the best to,
right,
you know, step up and you know, take on those responsibilities, whether it's, you know, our group or if it's, you know, somebody that you know, is in the audience or will see this on the replay on YouTube.
Right, right.
So.
Right. I'm just going to paste in a couple of links for you, Larry, to look at because this is all IRS-related stuff, so... you can basically derive.
When you look at the withheld documents, the overwhelming number of them are IRS. There's a couple of court orders that I think probably relate to that FBI sting that somehow got either Giacano or Trafficante on tape. And then there's just a couple of Kennedy donor interviews with for the book. So those are kind of things that we on our own can try to influence outside of a lawsuit. Their research, or look at them as research projects for our project, is sort of hopefully somebody has some contacts that we can exploit or utilize. The daughters are old enough now to make decisions on their own.
They're in the 50s.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're trying to do is we just want to get some, like the guy that with the Malcolm X, he was just released from jail after all these years. He was falsely accused of assassinating, of being one of the assassins. So there is a structure, and I believe that Dallas now has a Democratic district attorney. So perhaps they'll be more amenable to this idea of expunging or at least entertaining a court of inquiry.
The Freedom Project works on that. I mean, they went through all that stuff back in 20-odd years ago.
Yeah, the Innocence Project the Innocence Project is focusing on live people right now. I mean, like Sirhan, that would be something they would do. And there are people that are supporting Sirhan. And obviously also, we know how the Kennedy family is torn terribly about the Sirhan business. Kerry and Chris went on CBS News the other day, and they're looking. They had a whole their theological approach to Sirhan was really awesome. I don't want to waste time on that today. But Bobby and the other brother that works for Fox are the only ones that want that release. But the Innocence Project was focused on live people. We have to, on our own, go to the Kennedy, the Oswald daughters and say, look, the same reason, and by the way, this guy is now suing the federal government. The person that got released under Malcolm X, he's suing them for the reputational damage that was done to him all these years. He was in jail for 50 years.
Well, $100 a day. I wouldn't go further.
So I'm just saying that there is also some monetary benefit if we can get this done. I don't want that to be the main reason, but, you know, delicate conversation if someone is friendly and knows them.
Hey, Larry, this is Bob. You had asked me a question about that editorial. I think there may be some value in reaching out to the editorial staff at the Dallas Morning News. You know, they have a legacy from that moment to this moment with respect to the entire event. That legacy is all over the map, but,
I think I'm going to, the guy that, do we know any reporters in Dallas that we could, maybe they know who the people in that board would be the best people to contact?
You know, the irony, and again, as name droppy as this sounds, one of my neighbors was Mary Woodward, who, as you know, was a reporter at an early 20s and was probably one of the closest people to JFK at the moment of impact, and unfortunately she's passed away, but she lived a short distance from me, and we talked about that, but again, she was too new to understand the bigger thing. But beyond that, I don't have any knowledge. I could suggest some people who live in Dallas who do, but whether you want to reach out to Robert Groden about it, I don't know.
No, he would not be the right person. I gotta think about
just as a contact, I understand how you're feeling. You know, I've admitted to everybody that Robert's a personal friend of mine and has been for as long as I can remember. But the question was, how do you get a contact with somebody on the current staff, whether an editor or an editorialist? And understanding that newspapers have so few editors these days, I mean, they have.
You know, I'm thinking, Bob, that they must have covered this the news last week. I'm gonna have to see if they covered the release. Whoever that reporter is would be a good lead-in, probably, because somebody would have assigned him to cover this or her this case, and the person who assigned the person probably is a good source. But that's an excellent idea to go through the newspaper editorial.
And even if it was signed to a single person, that person would likely have had to have gotten permission by the editorial and potentially administrative staff of an ownership of the news. So there's some influence there. It's sort of implied.
But to make that kind of editorial, someone needed, you know, buy-in from a person that's above the editorial staff. So that actually was a very positive development, I thought. That's a great idea, Bob. I think I'll look into that about try to check some of the Dallas contacts to see who the best person. But we should but I don't think one of the Dallas girls no longer lives in one of the Oswald daughters. But I don't think one of them doesn't no longer lives in the Dallas area, right? Or well, I don't want to waste time, Dave. We're already 18 minutes past deadline. So
18 minutes.
You know, the other person that comes to mind, Larry, and I saw him on the call here briefly, is Gary Shaw. He lives in Cleveland, which is not too far from Dallas. He's been, I believe, a resident of that area for his entire life.
Yeah.
And
hey, Bob, I'll tell you what, I'm in contact with him every day. I talk with him almost every day. He's kind of like a father figure to me, even though I'm about 10 years younger than he is. But at the same time, let me pass that over to him and see if he has any information and any contacts there.
That's great. You and I, Casey, are in the same exact thing. Gary was a father figure to me, and Gary shared some personal experiences we had back in the 70s together. And in fact, I just did some work for him and sent him a package in the mail. I was going to ask him whether he got it, but he disappeared too quick.
It would be good. So, in other words, the way I view this is that if we can get the daughters, or at least one daughter, to agree to let us bring this on, then we could go to the Dallas Morning News and publicize the what we're doing, which would put additional pressure on the district attorney to allow us to at least, you know, basically the idea is we're trying. I've told Marina, Bill and I sent her a letter back in 2017 that we don't want them, the daughters and her and their offspring, to become like the Mudd family. You know, the guy, the Don that treated John Wilkes Booth, and they still have not exonerated or expunged his conviction. So we want to try to, you know, it's for the benefit of her progeny. She got to compel her. So at least maybe the daughters.
And you could devise a conversation with the new staff that would, in effect, call them out. In other words, it's one thing to write an editorial, but it's another thing, if you will, to follow up on it in some meaningful way. It could be just in the niche of what they do, which is print media, or it could actually be maybe some form of, you know, of lobbying from print news or who knows what else. But the conversation has to be such that they're not backed into a corner on, you know, in the first minute of the first round. And I'm sure Larry, as an attorney, you know all that. I'm not advising other than that's what's coming to mind. So there may be some leverage here that who knows.
And that's why it's also important who the who the messenger is. A Robert Groden is not going to be, the right person to go to.
Yeah. Just to clarify that, I was only suggesting Groden as a person to get a contact name, but absolutely I wouldn't. I think Groden would probably cause them to reverse their editorial.
I would actually try to pick a local lawyer that we trust, and there's a couple down there, to be the one that, you know, does their outreach, because, you know, New York or California lawyers are not going to be – that's not going to be a good result either. We need this to be someone that they trust and know.
Hey, I was going to say, before everybody gets off here, I just want to it's been 58 years, guys. We're closing 58 years on this murder case, and we have come a long way, and we still have a lot of ways to go. And I know Bill Simpich says that all the time. But, you know, I personally want to thank everybody for all the work that they're doing in keeping this up and trying to keep it alive and for all the information that you guys have brought out over the years. So I just want to close off by basically saying I wish everybody health and wealth and the other thing is happy holidays, because you know, with all this virus and crap that we were talking about, it's awful, and I I hope everybody is safe and healthy and has a very good holiday season. So I'm going to close out here for you guys, then I'll let David close it out. But thank you guys for all the things you're doing, and we'll see you next year.
Hey, Casey, before you go, and you mentioned Gary Shaw, and I've always been curious to ask Gary how he feels about what happened to Larry Ray back in 96, if he thought that that was just an accident or if that was part of this whole thing, you know. Obviously it must have affected him, you know, and you know, sort of must have shocked him, actually, you know. And do you have any thoughts of maybe how, you know, how he feels about that?
Yeah, I do. And it's a touchy feely subject with him, even right now, and especially
be,
with and especially with the four or five people that he was around at that time, and they all happened to, you know, die within a certain period of time. And I think that's why he hung things up for a while. And now I think he feels good about the idea that there are other organizations and other people that are willing to go out and continue, you know, with what he's doing and with what we're doing. But, yeah, I'm in contact with him quite a bit, and I ask him questions about that. And he says that someday he'll break open and tell us. But and I don't know. Let me pass that on to him, and because I think you're right. I think that he thinks that some of the people who died around him were murdered, and I started mentioning names, and he goes, "Well, I don't want to go into that right now." And I just said, you know, because it's I do think that's the reason why he got out of the research business for a while, and hung things up, because I think it just scared the hell out of him. And I think this whole Roscoe White thing scared him to death. And I think that some of the things that they were on, in fact, the book that I'm reading now is Coup in Dallas. And there are some things that Gary says, holy cow, he says, we were writing an article on that. And he says, Albarelli put the damn thing out. And he says, no wonder some of those co-authors are upset about this. And even with the sudden death of, Albarelli, that's questionable right now too, as to whether or not he actually had a heart attack and died, or, you know, maybe it was brought on. So, but yeah, let me pass that on to, Gary, and I'll, probably get back in touch with you, Larry.
Well, I was, you know, because his situation was so extraordinarily unique, you know, a one car accident driving through Atlanta. And I had just lost my youngest brother to a car accident probably, I think, the month before. So when that happened, it really, you know, shook me, you know. I also met Larry at the symposium in 93, and he was the most affable guy. He'd sit in the lobby and talk to everybody, and, you know, he was a great guy, you know. He's in his cowboy boots, you know, and everything, you know. My impression of him was that, and especially all the good work that he did with Gary, you know, he was a Ruby expert. You know,
yeah.
He was an expert. Yeah.
Who were we talking about, by the way?
Larry Ray Harris, Gary's co-author for Cover Up, 1996. He died very mysteriously in a one car accident in Atlanta, I think October of 96, something like that.
Huh.
Obviously what Gary was talking about, I mean, Casey here was talking about that it was very, very affected him, you know, for many years, and you know, that's what he's talking about.
Okay.
It could happen to any of us.
Well,
absolutely.
Not that there's been any mystery, but Gary was also dramatically affected by the sudden death of Bud Finsterwald, who had just seen that day. You know, both Gary and I worked for Bud for years. But
good point.
I don't know, Larry Rivera, whether there was any mystery around his passing, although I've seen discussion about it, and, you know, for fear of going another half hour, the whole side story of Finsterwald not being who he says he was another whole thing that I think Gary, you know, being a board member of the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, got wrapped up in as well. We talked about it for years, and you know, I would never want to speak for Gary, but, you know, I always thought Bud was an upstanding guy and never found any anything to indicate that he was not who he was, but as far as his passing, supposedly of a cardiac incident. But
how old was he when he died?
Oh, my goodness, I should know that. He had to have been in his late 60s, I think. I could look it up quickly, but
I think he was.
Does that sound right, Casey? Late 60s?
Yeah, I think he was. And the other thing, too, is that you had another passing of a guy by the name of Larry Howard. And holy cow, I'll tell you what, for about 14 days, I was doing research personally with him, and then all of a sudden I get a call from his wife saying that he passed. And I go, what do you mean he passed? And that was under a lot of suspicion, too. So I think all those little intricate deaths that have happened around and in directly involved with Gary Shaw, I think, I think it scared the hell out of him.
Hey, Casey, the attack, the knife attack on Jack White.
Oh, absolutely.
Wakes up to his naked guy, attacking him with a knife in his room while he's sleeping.
Sounds like I changed my first name, huh?
Jeez, I'll tell you.
By the way, speaking of principles, with the ARC.
Yeah.
Fencibles Archive is with the ARC, and Mary Fell's site. What's his name again? I'm completely fall blank now.
Bradford?
Yeah, Rex Bradford. They'll probably bring it to light within the next year or so, because he's already been working on doing some bits on digitizing stuff for the ARC, and Fencibles Archive is part of the collection of the ARC, so they'll probably digitize that soon as well.
Fencibles was 70, by the way.
70? Okay.
It's unbelievable that, he passed in 1991. It seems, in some ways to me, like yesterday, and yet it's that long ago.
Yeah.
But yet he was born in 21.
Wow.
Even before my parents. So.
Yeah, Gary told me basically that that Bud from time to time would be down at the Assassination Information Center in Dallas, and it was his money that kept that thing open, and several people ran that down there along with Gary Shaw, but at the same time,
Robert Johnson,
yes, absolutely. I'm assuming that Robert is still alive, because I saw him in Dallas, I'm going to say about 4 or 5 years ago, but I can't say for sure where he is and what's going on, but every once in a while, I'll end up going to some sort of a conference down there, and I'll see him, and he'll come up to me and he goes, hey, you remember me? Yeah, I know who you are. Yeah, geez. So, but yeah, let me talk to Gary and see what, there are a lot of incidents that have taken place, and I haven't totally forgot about Jack White, because I used to go down and see Jack White all the time. But God, I'm telling you, that would scare the bejesus out of me. I mean, he got stabbed. I mean, he was lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
Jeez. And then he still went on and did research and put out documentaries there. And I think his whole archive is down at in Baylor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. In fact, I pulled some of the stuff that he did, and because I did some overlays trying to confirm that he had identified Umbrella Man as Gordon Novell, and he actually had some profiles that he did side by side, but I went ahead and did overlays. And I would say that he was about, from my research, about 90% accurate on that identification. And I just posted an article on my blog on that, in case you guys want to check it out. And very, very interesting. And I went over to his website. He's got a lot of, everything is there on Jack.
Well, I'll pass this information on to Gary Shaw, and maybe we can, maybe he can get online and the next meeting we have, and kind of you know, talk a little bit about, you know, what has gone on in his life. But I also realized, too, that the co-authors of the book Coup in Dallas are have been warned.
Really?
About the possibility of letting that book out. And Gary Shaw and I talked, and he says, I don't think they're going to let it out.
So who warns them, and who where is the warning sent, to the publisher or to the authors?
To the authors.
And what is the nature of the warning?
I think it was based upon the idea that you cannot release some of these names because some of them are still alive.
Oh?
I just got back on going.
People will never die.
Is it someone threatening prosecution, or is it someone threatening physical harm?
I think it might be both, but I think it was the latter one where was physical harm, and I think it just scared a bunch of them, both of them. And I'm sitting there going, "Wow!" I said, I told Gary, I said, "If this book doesn't come out, you have a transcript that you're reading." I said, "Make me a copy. I want to read it." Well, I'm in my second reading right now.
Was the person making the threat, did they purport to be from the government or from someone, so just a private person?
That I don't know. And
I would like to try to find out, like, who they said they were from, and what were they threatening? Like, was it, like, these names, or you cannot disclose these names because they're confidential information protected by the federal government, or, you know, these are names that if you release them, you're going to be in, you know, doodle.
Yeah, I don't know, but I'll do a search on that and see if they will release any information to us, and maybe even get them on our program here.
I don't want to put them at risk of exposing.
No, I don't. I'm
curious what the nature of the threat was and who was purporting to be the person making the threat. You know, I mean,
what you're saying is 58 years later, this is a dangerous pastime.
Oh, boy.
Well,
you know what? First of all, this is all based on rumor, okay? This is not somebody who comes in and goes, "I've had this such and such." So further than rumor, it doesn't go.
Yeah, but it is.
Biden says in September that 20 years is enough to release the 9/11 records, and why is 58 years?
Right.
Yeah.
I know this is probably irrelevant, but just shows you, to Bart's point about how paranoia can be driven by life events. I worked for many years in secret on a project for the Committee to Investigate Assassinations to develop a JFK database. And I had to work from midnight to six at a local institution. And I remember coming out to a place that was bordered. In other words, it was not even a public street, to find a bullet hole through my windshield and rear window of my car. And that, although it was never solved, I was in the midst of all of this back in my 20s, and it set up a level of paranoia that was unparalleled in my life. And of course, there was no basis to conclude anything about it, other than it was stunning that it happened on a private college campus. So gotta watch out for the unverified, conclusions from situations, as much as some of them are, at least the anecdotal information, if not circumstantial information, is so rich and compelling to lead to conclusions that we sometimes make. It's really tough to uncover the actual real evidence, if you will.
And so many other situations in this case are completely fortuitous. You know, it's like, how can this happen, you know?
Yeah. I'm not saying, you know, if the person knows, I just be interested. How, because that could be, you know, if the person says they're from the government, then that's actually more important to me than if it's just a private party, because that's.
You probably all remember when the movie Executive Action came out. I went down to the announcement of the movie in New York City, and they were passing out to each moviegoer a newspaper. Size, maybe 30-page document, in which it had all these questions. You were all familiar with every one of the details, pictures and everything. And they had a quote from, and I know you've all seen this, from the, I'm trying to think, the London Sunday Times.
Yeah.
Where they looked at the number of unexplained violent deaths, remember? And they
the actuary.
And the actuary included that the likelihood of it happening was 100,000, I'm going to say trillion, but it maybe it was million to one. And I always was curious about how actuaries come up with their statistical data. And I actually found that, at least at that time, it was something that was sound in probability and statistical science. And, you know, and of course that list, I've kept that list. I stopped managing the list about 5 years ago, but I mean, the list of deaths that are not comfortable explanations is in the hundreds now. But at the time, I think it was 14 or 16, you know, started with Lee Bowers and others. So to the point Larry Rivera is making, you know, a lot of coincidences were really opportunistic. You know, I mean, it really plays with your head and the way that we as human beings tend to want to generalize things and let things connect in our heads about what the answer to questions are, particularly very difficult to solve ones. So just an observation that I've made over the years. So.
Yeah, Bob, that pamphlet that they were handing out, you're right. It was about the size of a regular newspaper. It was 8 pages long, front and back, so 16 pages altogether. And they documented everything that they could. Probably about 90 to 95% of what was actually in the film. And I thought that was very, very interesting because I still have a couple copies of those things, and I used to hand them out in my classroom to the kids.
That was a really powerful document, Casey. I still have two or three copies, as you know. They're, you know, over the years they yellow and they become brittle. Yeah. But yeah, I also have, I think I have 3 or 4 copies of the complete press kit for the Dalton Trumbo film, and that in itself was a really fascinating insight into the way that the producers and so forth worked with, you know, it was who Burt Lancaster and Will Gere,
right.
Robert Ryan, and it was a fascinating thing that they put together.
Oh yeah,
and I actually have pictures that I can share with you that I took at the press conference, and it was loaded with press in New York City.
And for the time that this happened, Bob, you know, executive decision 1973. I mean, you know, consider the implications, you know, of that the cover up is still going full blast, you know, and Mark Lane writes this movie and they put it on film and everything. And the actors that you just mentioned, I mean, they were the best. I mean, they had already gone past their primes, obviously, but you know, it's sort of like reminiscent of Walter Matthau and Lemon. In JFK, you know, past their prime, but their contributions in the movie were very significant.
And what did we think about that as well? I'm sorry.
Is this about the commission, that film?
Executive decision.
Executive action.
Right. Executive action. Yeah.
By the way, so when I was at Rutgers when the movie came out, I took a date to the movie, which says a lot about me. We would know.
I'm not going to comment on that. So.
I think you should permanently block Schnapp in the future from this after that comment.
But the point was not that I took a date to the movie, but we were the only two people in the movie. It was like a
prime
time.
Really?
Yes. I took 4 students with me. And guess what? There were 8 people in the movie that I was in. It was a 2,500-seat movie theater, and the other 2 people sat behind us, and I told them Fred and Ethel, because they're our ages now, and she elbowed him and said, you know, this is just BS. This never happened this way. Let's get up and leave. And all my students looked at me, and they go, what's going on here? And I said, they're not ready for this. I said, good God, this is 1973-74. They are not ready for this stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, Larry, the comment that you made about the actors was significant because, you know, all 3 of those actors were well-established. They had earned their keep in Tinseltown,
mm-hmm.
and they normally commanded extensive fees. All 3 of them worked for scale.
Right. The
The other thing I did, we went out with these two Italian girls, and he took us back to this Italian house at Rutgers where the Italian girls live. And I spent from 2 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the morning, rather than try to smooth them, I was talking about the Kennedy assassination.
That's not going to get you anywhere. You know that, don't you?
Right. And so what happened was, and, you know, we'll get back, and then I'm wondering, why did they not, why were they not returning our calls?
This has been a brilliant lesson in life. Do not start talking about the Kennedy assassination. I'll tell you one thing. I did this once 8 years ago, and this girl went, the first thing she said, and I've always noticed this now, who did it? That's the first question they tell you, because they don't care about what you're doing and how much trouble you go through and how difficult it is and so forth. And they go, now, who did it? And I was like, oh, God. And then also, somebody else who is also in research said, like, wanted to bring up a discussion where they just ask you, and I'm going, don't ask me, because we're going to be standing here all night discussing this. I'm not kidding you. You will ask question after question, and I will answer them all. But I'm telling you, it's a total buzzkill. I want to go out and have a good time. So
I do notice, now that I'm back in the dating world, that the women now are much more responsive to my than they were when we were in college.
Well, that's good. That's because they know you're a rich lawyer, Larry.
Either that, or you're just so much more mature than you were back then, right?
I did put a copy of Executive Action in that same location as Revisited.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
And also, David had asked me privately, and then you sort of converted. He said, "Do you have a copy of the commission?" And I thought that I did, and there are several other movies called The Commission, one related to 9/11, one related to organized crime. I do not have it. I asked the question if anybody did, didn't get a reply. Have any of you seen that movie, and do you know anything about it? I mean,
we've been looking for it. We can't get it.
I can't find it anywhere either. So,
he holds it, and he doesn't want to release it.
I would love to be able to at least just digitize it.
He doesn't want to do it. He had, I think, a 12-hour version, and he's been slowly cutting into it, this, that, and the other. But he sits on this stuff, because he used to work with William Law a fair bit. Maybe he still does. But I've asked through William, I said, when the fuck do we get to see this goddamn film? I mean, he's been working on this damn thing for 15 to 20 years.
Well, the one that I'm talking about is the one that Mark Sobel produced back in 2003. That's only about an hour and a half.
He made a short version, but he doesn't want to release it because the original version was 12 hours long.
Oh, I was unaware of
that. 12 hours with Ed Asner and all these big wigs, you know.
It was shown at the Texas Theater as a premiere, but I think it was shown just one time, and one time only. And I've been trying to reach out to Mark Sobel, and even through his, through his contacts. And, you know, it'd be a great film to, you know, to release. And I think it was well done. Actually, a lot of the actors, they did their acting for free.
Yeah.
They didn't even get paid for it. But, you know, the clips I've seen of it, I mean, it looks like a tremendous, you know, film. But again, I'm just going by the clips I've seen, so.
Yeah, we should probably put an effort in, when I say we, whoever, you know, has the time and interest, to see if we can locate a copy of it, even to borrow and just rip to get it at least seen by some people. It would really be a nice thing. And, you know, I mean, the actors there were even more impressive than the actors in Executive Action. I think Martin Sheen was in it, and Martin Landau. And
yeah, he doesn't want to release it. He sits on it like it's gold. So,
but there's a DVD version of it that you see. If you Google for the commission, you have to add the word movie, you'll see that there's a cover of a DVD, it's reviewed in IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point it might have been commercially available.
Maybe he's selling it that way.
His website is inactive. I can't even get a reply from his website.
From what I understand, the IMDb ratings was when it was shown at the Texas Theater.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a rating from a digital commercially available, you know, buy a copy. The only place that I know you can stream it online, ironically, of all places, is in India. Because India has different streaming rules, and you can get it from Binder in India. But beyond that, I don't know where else you can get it. So
he's done several films, and I think he's done things on RFK as well, and so forth. And he just doesn't want to let go of them. That's all I know. But
you can't find it. Spoken to him about that. What's the point? It's like he's not. Where's the greater good if he doesn't let it?
He sees himself as an artist, and he doesn't see the product as finished. It's like the third Boston record. It took years before it came out. Or the latest Tool record, that took 13 years to produce.
So the perfect is the enemy to the good.
Hmm. What does that mean?
That means people that. Or it's classically the enemy of the good is the enemy to the, other words, basically what it means is that you can't, something is good, but you won't let it out because you want it to be perfect. And therefore, you know, you're not benefiting the greater good by keeping it.
Oh, gotcha.
Hey, listen, I got to leave before I go, because I got to leave the meeting. I found recently on YouTube, in case anybody's interested, the PBS Frontline program on Lee Oswald. It's there, complete. So in case you want to download it, you can go to YouTube and get that. It's very interesting. That was done in 2013 for the 50th anniversary.
What's the title?
It's the PBS program that came out on 2013 about Lee Oswald.
Is it accurate?
It's a little dated in some areas, but it's a pretty fair, you know, there are a lot of rare images and stuff. I didn't see the entire thing. I perused it, but it seems like, you know.
I mean, do they give short shrift to his associations, or they stick it strictly to the official?
They assume a lot of the, that's the problem. They assume a lot of the Warren Commission, you know, but there is, you know, there's good dynamics, you know, in the program. It's on YouTube, PBS Frontline, The Mystery of Lee Oswald or something like that.
Hey, Larry, before we all get off here, thank you very much for doing all that work on Blender.
Oh, yeah. I had an update when we started, but whatever you need, just let me know. I need, because Bruce asked me for a view from the storm drain, and I sent that right away.
Very good. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, guys.
All right. Well, you sign off here? I think
we'll wrap it up. And like I say, we'll wrap it up for the meeting and also for the year. And we'll be back again in January. But I want to wish everybody a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and enjoy your maybe you'll take a break, or maybe you'll throw yourself heavily into your research over the next couple of weeks. But definitely, like I say, we'll be back again in January. Definitely check out the Project JFK website, and if you click on the events tab, you'll find the next meeting release date when we're going to be together, and make sure you sign up for your e-ticket. If you're there and you want to make a donation to the website or through the website to us, you can do that on the homepage through the Support Our Cause section on the donate button through PayPal. You can always do that. So with that, like I say, it's been an incredible year and a good meeting today. And with that, take a look at the documents if you get a chance. Look at the list. Go back in the chat log. It will be up with the replay sometime tomorrow. You'll be able to click on the link that Larry Rivera shared that has the entire PDF download. Or it's there right now before we, end the meeting. But other than that, I want to thank everybody for, for participating and,
I really hope you cut that whole COVID malarkey out.
Gotta make that little clip out. So, I'll get that done.
Hey, David, and also extend our compliments to Brian on his contributions to Tone's video. I thought he did a great job.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I'll do that. And maybe if we get a chance, Bob, we can talk. You said you've got a press kit in one of those papers. If you might maybe make a donation to, you know, put that in our archives, that'd be something. I've never seen the press kit. I've seen the newspaper. I don't own a copy of it, but I've seen it. Maybe we could put that in, if you're willing to donate instead of that, maybe we can put that in the Project JFK archives.
I'd be happy to talk with you offline, David, about that whole concept. As you might imagine, you know, I'm Casey's age, and I'm thinking about my collection. And, in fact, last month I've been going through stuff and finding things that I had no idea that I had. And I have some locations and whatever that I'm considering. I know libraries are remiss to take it because they just don't have the room.
Right.
So we can talk about that. But at minimum, Casey, I'm sorry, David, I'm going to make a note. I'm going to scan all of those documents, at least make them available to you digitally.
That'd be great. That'd be great, Bob. We appreciate that. All right. Well, with that, again, I'm David Knight with Project JFK CSI Dallas, and I'm going to bring the journey meeting for December to a close, and we'll see everybody in 2022.
Stay safe, everybody.
Look forward. Yeah. Have a good festivities. Ciao.
Thanks again, everybody.